Okay, today is February 26th, 2014. This is the first interview with Paul Buell. You know, Paul, I never asked how you pronounce your last name.
Did it just right.
Okay. This is a phone interview. Paul's at his home in Madison, and I'm in my office at Steenbach Memorial Library. Paul, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Very good. Paul Buell, alternatively Paul Merlin Buell, to give you my middle name, which is my father's first name. I was born September 27, 1944 in Urbana, Illinois.
Thank you. And Paul, I have a copy of your book and that you edited, and then your article in it. So some of these straightforward questions I'm not necessarily going to ask because they've been asked and answered in a certain way.
Very good.
But I do want to talk a little bit about your parents. It doesn't, at least in what I'm reading in Radical American Me, I don't see a lot of discussion about your parents.
That would be correct. My mother was born in Eliza, Illinois, in 1905, a town so small it was sold, as they say, lock, stock, and barrel for $500, a fact which appeared as a curiosity in Ripley's Believe It or Not a comic strip in the newspapers of the 1940s. And she was the granddaughter of an abolitionist named Ezra Fuller, who came from Maine to Missouri in the 1850s and was chased across the border ahead of a mob, supposedly, to Illinois. And he later enlisted in the Union Army and marched with Sherman through Georgia and lived to a ripe old age and spent some time in my mother's parents' home, reveling them in stories. His nephew was a drummer boy, more of a collateral relation of my mother, but that tradition was very much alive in my family, which had become Republicans in 1856 and remained ever since, until myself. My father's lineage was German on one side, going back to the lower middle class in Heidelberg, Germany, and the 1850s, and his mother's side was from rural Indiana with the possible collateral relative named Bell Boyd, who was a Confederate spy and bed-hopping activist who went on the vaudeville stage after the Civil War, much as Sojourner Truth did, and happened to die in the Dells after a performance, I think in the 1880s, a very colorful character, and certainly the most colorful in my family, if she really, according to claims, was in my family. At any rate, whereas my mother's father was a short time school teacher and later mowed lawns with a big machine for the city of Aledo, and was very poor, as my mother was very poor growing up in the town that they removed to, Aledo, Illinois, small town. My father's father was a failed medical student and set up a little grocery store in Moline, Illinois, where he grew up, and according to a legend, joined the Ku Klux Klan just long enough for Grandma to take his sheet away. Moline is the middle class city between Moline, Davenport, and Rock Island. And I recently read a memoir of somebody from Moline, and about 20 years younger, and that author notes that the Congregational Church was the evidence of middle-class respectability, and that would be my father's family to the T. Ultimate middle-class respectability, although the husband, my father's father, lost the grocery store, worked as a skill worker in the Rock Island Arsenal, and left the family as soon as the youngest child was 6 years old, and left my grandmother a grass widow, as they say, and went off to work in the war industry in California as a skilled worker. So that's sort of the family lineage wrapped up. And I can go a little further by saying my father was a geologist, a geophysicist, whose job for the state of Illinois was to find groundwater supplies for farmers in small towns. In central Illinois, I learned after his death, he was described as Mr. Resistivity because of the method used to locate gravel deposits, which was the surest sign of there being a water supply. And he spent a great deal of time in the field with a machine and a number of locals finding usually the ne'er-do-wells of a small town, putting copper and other stakes into the ground and thus sending electricity through the ground and finding if those gravel pits were there. And sort of like water witchery come true through science. My mother was wished to be a social worker, took a degree in nursing in Chicago in the 1920s, met Jane Addams, and was stirred to go to Manhattan and become a settlement house worker in the 1930s after graduating from University of Iowa, where my father graduated. And as she worked in the Kelly Street settlement house, she realized that if she were going to have a family and children, she would have to accept my father's proposal of marriage and move with him to Champaign, Illinois, where the Illinois State Geological Survey resided. This was very happy for him and very unhappy for her. In later years, she was a registered nurse. She tried to talk about unionization, even though she was a lifelong Republican. She was blacklisted, suffered various kinds of woes, physical and mental, and was unhappy in her situation, as I came to understand it in later years, but determinedly feminist in the 19th century sense of believing there would be no wars if only women could rule the world, but also that the repeal of prohibition had been a terrible idea. That more or less sums up my congregational lower middle class civil service worker and nurse status in Champaign.
Thank you, Paul. Did you have any siblings?
Yes, I have a sister, blood sister, who was 4 years older than me, and because parents who gave up on having children and adopted infrequently had a child, have an adopted sister who was also 4 years older than me, and one lives still in Champaign, the evangelical sister, and the other lives in Winnetka and is a retired librarian and a liberal Republican or perhaps even a quiet supporter of Obama and a liberal Episcopalian.
Not that it matters that much, but is the blood sister, so to speak, is she the evangelical or is it the adult?
No, the other way around.
Okay. All right.
But you might say, and I have thought to myself often when I was writing Abraham Lincoln for Beginners, which is really a book for young people, that Lincoln's milieu in Illinois after his family moved there was not very different from my own. The central part of the state is full of people that came from Indiana and Kentucky, white, conservative, Republican, tending towards evangelical religion. And Lincoln made it through those years by being a successful lawyer, but also by disguising his free thinking. And I suppose I found myself growing up in Champaign as a free thinker, feeling more or less the same way as they used to say in the 19th century, the village atheist.
Thank you for that, Paul. So growing up in Champaign and going to school, were there teachers or cohorts that helped to nurture, even though you said it was sort of closeted free thinking, any
yeah.
teachers or students that helped to nurture?
Well, I only mentioned two or three. In eighth grade, I had an African-American history, U.S. history teacher. And as I look back, I'm astounded at how much effect he had upon me thinking of myself becoming a historian. He had been he was a native Champaign person who had been educated at the Sorbonne and then by a misunderstanding perhaps came back to Champaign to take more graduate courses. I never finished a PhD and teach in junior high school, which he did the rest of his career, and did a few brave things in terms of housing integration, but basically remained one of the very, very few African-American teachers of any kind. They're the only one I ever encountered in junior high school or high school, but I was very struck by him, and I'm sure that it had to do with his personality, but also with the abolitionism that I recovered. But I remember he showed a documentary film that was supportive of unionization in the South, and that seemed stunning to me as a young Republican. I couldn't understand it. Secondly, when I was about 15, moved to town. Ralph Kies, same spelling as Kies Avenue in Madison, whose father had worked in the Henry Wallace campaign in 1948 and was blacklisted, essentially, was a city planner in Puerto Rico for 15 years, and then managed to get this job at University of Illinois. Ralph's father was a hard-bitten Quaker, and his mother was a disciple of Kropotkin, but they both were Adlai Stevenson devotees. So Ralph was half Jewish, half Quaker, and in their household, we watched Viva Zapata when it came on the television. We had discussions about civil rights and peace and so forth that I could not have had in the home of any other fellow student. And that was pretty extraordinary, and a way for me to grow into things. I remember when the Hands Off Cuba ad appeared in the daily newspaper, I signed it immediately and gave them my friend Ralph's phone number, and they called me at his house, which was sort of discomforting for his mother, understandably. But I was part of a very hidden left-wing milieu within Champaign, and I suppose you could also say within the Democratic Party, which was very small in Champaign-Urbana and limited to university people, more or less. And a third, a saxophone-playing African-American who was an intellectual, a very interesting guy, a year older than me. He has been a gay doctor in Harlem for almost 40 years was the person for whom I would drive into the ghetto in Champaign, something I hadn't done otherwise, though I surely would do so again when the civil rights movement briefly came to town and I would drive to meetings. But rarely would white people drive into the ghetto, and at that point it was one of the most segregated cities in Illinois, so that rarely would non-whites be in the 90% of town except as servants and service workers.
Paul, thank you for that. So I grew up with, well, they still are, very Republican parents, and I always sort of felt myself that I was Republican just because of them until I realized, I wasn't. Did you have any sort of epiphany like
you know,
that?
I think my revelatory events, even knowing one always recasts these things in memory, may have been seeing about the civil rights events on television, but also in the drugstore, local drugstore, where I would go to the paperback rack and pick up new science fiction books of every good and terrible kind, wonderful ones like The Space Merchants, which was very caustic and written by people who had been close to the Young Communist League in their youth in New York, but also some nonfiction books. And the two nonfiction books that stood out were Why We Can't Wait by Martin Luther King Jr., and Listen Yankee by C. Wright Mills. And I can remember the days I bought those books, because I took them home and they became my Bible, so to speak. They were very, very significant to me. Opened my eyes, so forth and so forth. Because the civil rights movement came to town in 1960, and I spontaneously joined a picket line, not knowing anything about it in a dull summer afternoon, but walking downtown and seeing this picket line, certainly the most exciting day in my life since I had thrown a no-hitter in Little League. Those would be two peak days in my youth, young life. Enrolled myself in it energetically. It didn't last too long. And in truth, because there were no Democrats in town to speak of, because elections were a certain principle, Republicans would be elected as they were in Champaign County every year in the 20th century except for 1936 and 1976, I think, because of the Nixon debacle. At any rate, I don't think it occurred to me that there was some meaningful alternative to the Republican Party that I could join and be part of. So that even being a quote-unquote liberal hardly crossed my brow. We can get into this in a little bit later, but when I became a socialist at age 18, I seemed to have gone from being a naive Republican to a beatnik cynic into being a socialist without much in between.
Thank you again for that, Paul. There's one thing I want to to just touch on it again, it comes from the piece that you wrote in the book that you edited.
Uh-huh.
And it says, within a year, I saw in Madrid, by pure chance. So you were in Spain at some point growing up?
Yes, only for a few days. In the summer of 1960, my parents went on one of those $10 a day tours to Europe. We drove, that is to say, my father drove all the way from the UK to Spain. And it was sort of eye-opening the way it would be for an ordinary American teenager in the 1960s, exotic and different and so forth and so forth. But while we were in Madrid, I saw a man racing down the street, pursued by these political police, as I knew they, as I came to know what they were. They had a very particular helmet. Then I saw people leaning over with clubs and beating this person, and then I saw a body covered, entirely covered, and soaked in with sheets soaked in blood. And I don't think that my mother and father and my one sister, they didn't know what to make of it, you know. It was just so far outside their experience. It was like some American exotic thing that you'd see that didn't make any sense, and so it didn't leave such a big lasting impression on you. But it left a very distinct impression on me, presuming that I was ready for it. Maybe I've been reading about Francisco Franco or something or other. I couldn't cast it in the light of anything left, right, or anything like that, but I guess I had a feeling for what fascism was.
Thank you. So again, in this piece, you talk about going to, I'm guessing, Champaign for undergraduate. Why did you choose?
I need to probably to mention one more thing.
Okay.
Along the way, which is the Congregational Church was so locked into university life that it closed in the summer, and consequently there was no youth group. So I looked for another youth group, was sort of the only social outlet in Champaign. And a friend or someone I admired was part of the University Place Christian Church, which happened to be, though I didn't know it, the Disciples of Christ, a southern-based denomination, predominantly conservative because of its southern location, but sort of just bland in Champaign-Urbana among the other churches. But they had a very active youth group. They had, above all things, a pool table. And I joined the Christian Youth Fellowship, CYF. It was a wonderful opportunity for me to evangelize about civil rights. And the leaders of this group, the two youth leaders, who were a husband and wife in their 30s, sort of encouraged anything. I couldn't tell if they were sympathetic, but they thought it was good that somebody was idealistic. So they made me an officer of some kind. I still don't know what kind of officer I was. And on the basis of being an officer, I was appointed to the newly created Champaign-Urbana Youth Council, which was made up, I think, of church representatives. And we met several times in the fall of 1962, and I realized that it was a do-gooders group which intended to do nothing whatsoever about the crushing burden of racism. And it's further alienated me. I have to go back and say that there had been a race riot in the public park very close to our high school, and I had stood in the middle of the park and said, "Brothers, your enemy is elsewhere," or something like that, and somebody picked up a brick bat and was going to hit me. And then happily the police came. But I was looked upon, mostly in a hostile way, as a civil rights evangelist of sorts, of a non-religious sort. And I was happy to claim that identity. Maybe it was better than any other identity that I had. But after this experience with the youth council, or for other reasons, I just wanted to get out of high school. And so I graduated early in January of 1963 and came to the university. And in as much as I graduated in January, I didn't really have any choice about where to go to school, nor did I have any idea. One other footnote, and when I was teaching at Brown, I was to meet as a freshman advisor several freshmen from Champaign-Urbana, and every single one of them had gone to University High School, which was the prep school in town. You had to make a decision when you were 12 years old to go there, and it was if not predominantly Jewish, at least took away every Jewish kid I knew at age 11. They all disappeared and went to university high school. Why I didn't go, I'm puzzled to this day. I don't know. I was afraid of leaving my common milieu, although I probably would have been better if I had. At any rate, those kids, they went off to the Ivy League, whereas Champaign High, Urbana High was almost like Uni High. It was full of professors' children, or had a lot of them. Champaign High was lower middle class, and the teaching level wasn't very good, and it was a very natural thing to go to the U of I. In my case, actually saving money to live at home and go to the U of I. So I was still going to classes, but they were now across town.
Okay. Thank you for that. So one more thing about the transition. It sounds like you graduated early. As you were making that transition from high school to college, did you have an idea of what you wanted to major in or what you wanted to be?
I had the idea. I'd already been drinking as much beer as I could get my hands on, and I had the idea that being a high school teacher was a great thing because you could spend the summer drinking beer. Where otherwise I got the idea of being a history teacher, I feel sure came from this African-American teacher of eighth grade.
Okay. So one thing, one of those touchstone moments of American history, so it's around this time, if we're, you know, as we're sort of going chronologically here in 1963, that President Kennedy was assassinated. I'm wondering if you could speak to your memories of
indeed,
that event.
Indeed. A little more fill in here. In the summer of 1963, and now I've got my chronology wrong because I actually began college in January of 1962. Sorry.
Right. Okay.
In the summer of 1963, a young beatnik girl who I'd met in the folk song club of University of Illinois, sort of a center for dissenting everything. It included people who took marijuana and the available other drugs, sort of beatnik women from New York who wore leotards and very much closeted gay and lesbians and so forth. So it was that sort of cultural milieu in a big fraternity sorority campus. Anyway, this young woman and I left Champaign on a bus for San Francisco, thinking that we would have a big cultural experience. And we did. We went on living together, and we've been married for 50 years. At any rate, in the summer of 1963, I found a socialist newspaper, the only socialist newspaper that could be found in San Francisco, and by September joined the Socialist Labor Party, a small, largely blue-collar group that had been in existence since the 1890s and held what were called impossibilist positions. That is to say, nothing was worthwhile doing except getting rid of capitalism. It was a very interesting group because it believed in the disintegration of the state, the dissolution of the state, and its replacement by workers' councils, which were entirely functional and not political in the normal sense of political. It was a remnant of the era of the industrial workers of the world, and only in a time when there was so little ability, opportunity to plug into things would I have been part of it, but it was an intellectual experience valuable to me. Meanwhile, things were heating up politically in the early free speech movement across the bay, but it didn't really reach so much into San Francisco until about the time we were leaving in December of 1963. And in the meantime, I went to San Francisco State, and the very day that Kennedy was assassinated, I had a large handful of socialist leaflets I was going to pass out on campus. But my roommate, soon to be my wife, Mary Jo, said, "This is not a good day for handing out socialist leaflets." And I thought about it for a bit, and I thought, yeah, that's probably right. So it was shocking. People were crying on campus. It might be remembered, San Francisco State had many, many returnee students who were working at various jobs in San Francisco, and it was far more left-wing, as San Francisco was far more left-wing than the normal student population, and much less Catholic than many schools where the death of Kennedy was a huge trauma as the first Catholic president. But there was enormous anxiety, even in liberal San Francisco. Francisco about this change, and also just people wondering what in the world is going to happen now.
So you and Mary Jo decided to return to Champaign?
We had no choice. The opportunity to get into Berkeley, it was almost impossible if you were from out of state, and also very expensive. So very reluctantly, we returned to University of Illinois.
So once back, were you still thinking of education or high school teacher as a...
Here I got puzzled, and I was thinking of myself as a professional revolutionary, a very strange notion, which appeared and disappeared in the 1960s and 1970s, but of course had a long and honorable tradition in the later 19th century and early 20th century. So that I was reading everything I could get my hands on, thinking about how I could get to New York and how someday there would be a new socialist movement and I could work in or even direct an academy of socialists in the true European fashion. I wanted to educate, to be an educator, but I didn't have any idea of how I could be an educator and being in public school or private school for that matter in a normal college or university was something that was disappearing from my mind. Meanwhile, the draft, the war was picking up, the Vietnam War was picking up by 1965, and it was clear that people like myself were highly subject to the draft. So that when Mary Jo and I graduated in January of 1966, we had already made plans for me to continue my education by going to graduate school in pretty much the first place that asked me to, accepted me for a graduate study, and that was University of Connecticut in Storrs.
Okay. So I asked a question about possible teachers of note or cohorts of note in high school.
Yes,
what about in college?
I'm going to ask. Yes, there were a number of interesting professors, but doubtless the one who connected me to go to University of Connecticut and really, in the long run, directed me to come to University of Wisconsin was a guy named Rudolf Vacoli, who would become the founder of the Center for Immigration History at Minneapolis-St. Paul, a real, real important institution for the history of the especially European immigrant working class coming to the U.S. He was a young history teacher then at University of Illinois before he went to Minnesota and did that. And then he also also sent me to another UW graduate who was a Finnish American with communist parents in the University of Connecticut, A. William Hoagland. Quietly gay, quietly left-leaning character who was a real scholar of immigration as well. They both had been students of Curdy, which is an interesting connection for my life. But there were other, very few other professors who were anti-war. I didn't even necessarily have them as professors, but they sponsored anti-war activities, and one of them sponsored the Students for Democratic Society chapter. And that I joined as soon as I found out it existed on campus in September 1965. I had gone to the SDS-led or SDS-called demonstration against the war in April 1965 in Washington because suddenly a place appeared on the private plane or chartered plane that went from Champaign to D.C. in April 1965. A big thrill for me and probably due to the same professor. I mentioned her without being able to remember her name because she had been a young Communist League colonizer of Gary steel mills in 1950, as a few thousand other young communists were, and then dropped out of that activity and went back to school, got a PhD, became a professor, and sort of conveniently put that past away because it was dangerous to her career, but had strong left-wing sentiments. And was part of a very small and mostly hidden group of professors who would never reveal themselves in Champaign as having any kind of Marxist affiliations, but were encouraging when some young person would affiliate with them, show an interest. And when the SDS chapter reformed, I found myself almost immediately the spokesperson, notably at the October 21st, the first fall campus demonstrations against the Vietnam War. When I say spokesperson, I mean MC at the rally, the person that spoke on local education television, WILL, and appeared to do these public things very surprisingly to myself then and for some years later, until a former fellow SDS member in Champaign-Urbana reminded me that almost the entire chapter was Jewish and from Chicago, and they were very eager to have a Gentile from downstate be their face to the crowd.
Right.
I believe I paid them back by learning Yiddish and becoming a scholar of the Jewish left, but we'll get to that on another day.
Right. There's a question I want to ask. It's not on the list, but you mentioned the idea of meeting people who were gay or lesbian.
Uh-huh.
The world's changed a lot in 50 years, and really has changed a lot just recently.
Yeah.
Would these people come out to you as gay and lesbian?
To me. Very, very hesitantly. It was more as if one would be at parties and somebody would say something, you know, or like a woman 3 or 4 years older, that is to say, could buy alcohol, who was from Mary Jo's hometown of North Chicago, Illinois, that's just next to Waukegan across the border, one of those industrial towns that lost its industry in the last 30 years. She was a dynamic, magnetic personality for 3 or 4 young men, including me, but sexually unavailable or unattainable, and quote-unquote spent the summer in Greenwich Village. And it later became clear that she was, you know, quietly in the closet, and whether she was sexually active or not, that I don't know. And likewise, in the folk song group and club, I don't think it's that there was anything physically or in terms of behavior identifiable. People were pretty cautious about that. And yet, the stories would sort of come out. They were affable, progressive, but it didn't appear as if there would ever be any kind of breakthrough. It was as if there was this very, very special university milieu in which all kinds of things could be hidden, and most of the things that could be hidden happened in the same milieu, which put it very much under the watchful eye of the local FBI, as we were to find out.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the chapter you wrote for your book, the idea that the chief of security was also the FBI. It sounds like that's something you found out, that connection later?
Not greatly later, because I always wanted that his personality, him as a figure, that was known on campus. And when we would sit in bars and an older man with a trench coat would be at the next table, it wasn't very hard to figure out this is what they had in mind. What I learned, I think at the time or shortly after, was that my sister, who's in Champaign and is an evangelical, she and her husband were part of the Civil Air Patrol, which is sort of a social group of a kind who liked airplanes. Another member of the group was a local FBI agent, not the top agent on campus, but it was normal to have an FBI agent, just like another hobby of a military-minded person. And my sister had broached the subject of my being in the Socialist Labor Party, so I think a small investigation opened when I was 19. And then I became a spokesman for SDS on campus, and things sort of grew after that.
Okay. You said you went to Connecticut, you and Mary Jo went to Connecticut specifically to, you know, try to get into graduate school as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
So how did and I think you allude to this in the book, or you might say it directly, but how does the transition then go between Storrs, Connecticut and Madison, Wisconsin?
Well, Storrs was a very beautiful place in those days, but it was very much of a lower middle class commuter campus, and consequently very, very difficult to organize politically. I was the leader of a very weak SDS chapter. We were able to have an occasional lecturer to come in, and dozens of people would come and hear that lecturer and pass out leaflets at various times. But it really wasn't very much, and it probably was the weakness of the SDS chapter that prompted me to try to have some other useful role in relationship to SDS at large. And that, more than anything else, caused me to have the idea of starting this magazine to educate SDSers fundamentally, because the Radical Education Project set up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, had as its aim to reach these undergraduates who were in the SDS milieu in dozens of chapters, finally hundreds, and give them some kind of basis of knowledge in politics. My chosen area was the history of the American left. I had written an honors thesis on Daniel DeLeon, who had been a great figure in the Socialist Labor Party way back before he died in 1914, and had a developing interest in other kinds of things related to the history of the left. And then I should add, for a summer of 1966, Mary Jo and I lived in New York City because I worked at the National Guardian, which was then a solid left-wing weekly newspaper that had been very close to the milieu around Henry Wallace, the Progressive Party candidate of 1948, and was very good on civil rights, very good against the war, and was quietly supportive of, if not really the Soviet Union, or at least the idea that the Cold War was a bad idea, and so was the most attractive opposition paper. All I did was to collect ads and do other kinds of menial tasks in that summer of 66. But we lived there, and I took a class at what was called the Free University of New York with James Weinstein, the foremost historian of American socialism, who had founded, no, been part of the founding and editing of the journal Studies in the Left. Okay, by 1966, Studies in the Left folded. It had moved from Madison to New York and then hit some kind of political obstacle that couldn't go ahead. And therefore, there was a vacuum of some kind. And on that basis, and with almost no money and with the most primitive mechanical means, I managed to publish one issue of Radical America in stores, circulated mainly through contacts in SDS through the Radical Education Project. And by the time I came to Madison, an SDS activist and the creator of pamphlets from the SDS chapter on various subjects, a really wonderful organizer, Jim O'Brien, had already volunteered over the summer in correspondence to join with me, to encourage me to publish Radical America in Madison on a better, more solid basis. And it was to be printed one page at a time by Henry Hoslock, who was not only a longtime math graduate student teacher, but also the head of SDS and the leading figure in the negotiations over founding a teaching assistance association. So by sleeping at Henry Hoslock's the first couple nights in August 1967, before we found an apartment on Spade Street on the east side, we had sort of met everybody. Walking from Henry Hoslock's house, now a vanished area next to the railroad tracks, to the campus, passing a softball game that included a dozen left-wing personalities, including Evan Stark. I remember them shouting, come and join us. And I said, I don't have time, I'm a Marxist. And I think it was either Evan Stark or Bob Cohen who shouted back at me, we have all the Marxists we need already, what we need is a second baseman. there I was plunged into something which I recognized as the Midwest that I'd always wanted to be in, not Champaign, or not Bloomington, not Columbus, Ohio, but Madison, or I suppose Ann Arbor or Minneapolis might have been in the same category, but a Midwest that was felt like home to me, but the home I hadn't had, and had a radical tradition of its own and plenty of vibrant intellectual life, and left-wing people didn't have to disguise themselves as they had in Champaign-Urbana.
Thank you, Paul. Before I forget, I don't think this is actually on our list. I wonder if you could speak to the physical nature of publishing, whether it was the issue in stores or the issues in Madison, because publishing obviously is completely different in 2014 indeed than it was then.
I'm trying to remember how the first issue was even published. Probably at a Xerox shop if they existed in 1966, but I'm not certain they did. If not, it may have been mimeographed. At any rate, as soon as it got to as soon as we got to Madison, I got that one issue out. As soon as we got to Madison and stapled with individual staples as if it were a pamphlet and not a magazine. When we got to Madison, Jim O'Brien and Hank Hoslock introduced me to the saddle stitch stapler, which is to say, pages would be printed on both sides, 8.5 by 11. They would be collated, put onto this saddle stitch, so that they could be stapled on the edge, so that they look three staples. So they look sort of magazine-like, and then put into mailing envelopes to send to SDS chapters or to individuals, and taken to the post office. There was one on University Avenue, now where the Chazen is now, and another post office on Winnebago. And one place or the other, I would load up everything on my VW and make a couple of trips and send them all out. But I've forgotten about a stage. There was a kind of green semi-plastic covering to a newspaper. We would type out the finished article on those, correct it with some kind of green correcto material, and then that's what Henry Hoslock used to create a photographic, reversal photographic image, and then print it. So it was more cumbersome than one could imagine, but on the other hand, the entire thing was incredibly cheap, and postal rates were, by even the standards of the mid-70s, unbelievably low. And if Radical America lost money with virtually every issue, it didn't lose very much money.
Thank you. So you said you and Mary Jo found an apartment on Spate Street, right?
Right, that's correct.
Sometimes we get Spate and State. I wanted to make sure that we really hit
well,
that
Well, this is of great moment to me, because I'm working with the mayor on his memoirs, and so I'm recalling or drafting recollections of the East Side as the old industrial center where Gishel Tool had not yet closed down. It was in the process of closing down, where the blue-collar working class had not yet moved out, which is to say moved west along Atwood out to Monona. And where the two family houses that are basically the neighborhood, much of the neighborhood, were not yet occupied by graduate students, and where, to put the point a little more strongly, the city administrations until 1968 had been inclined to take urban renewal or urban removal funds to essentially make the East Side into a sacrifice zone and run a highway over the last two blocks of Williamson, with the idea that nothing could happen in the East Side because now, with industry gone, it was just going to collapse more or less. Thanks to Paul Soglin and a number of others, none of those plans took place. And meanwhile, the very year that I moved there, dozens of other graduate students moved within just a few blocks of me. The apartments were $75 a month plus heat. And a very, very accommodating in many ways. The bars changed over their populations very quickly and very successfully, and the neighborhood revived in a remarkable new fashion. Even by the time we left in 1971, it was very largely transformed, and it was certainly the center of the meetings of the Teaching Assistants Association and a wide variety of left-wing and cooperative movements.
So it sounds like you not only found a place that you considered to be home, a neighborhood sort of built around you and others. So September 1967, the next month, is the Dow riot, which is...
Or the Dow police riot, as we like to call it.
The Dow police riot. I wonder if you could... I know you've talked about this in other places, but I wonder if you could speak
to
your
memory. Well, I'll make it brief because I have talked about other places. Mary Jo was working on the History of Wisconsin series at the Historical Society from the first day we got to campus. She got that job and retained it even when she was a teaching assistant for, I think, a year and a half. I was just going to graduate school, and when the plans were announced for the sit-in, I didn't have even a second thought about going. I just automatically went without thinking about it. But I feel sure, and Paul Soglin says as well, that we really did not expect the police to come in and bash us. We thought simply being there was, you know, what we would, while we were making witness in the almost Quakerish sense. And we were stunned by the level of violence of the police. Contrary to everything David Marinus has written in his account, they were overwhelmingly hostile, slugging women as well as men with their clubs, and they were deeply influenced by and directed by Chief Inspector Herman Thomas, who, as everybody knew, although Marinus would never say so, had Birch Society materials in his outer office and regarded SDS and the student movement as a whole as dangerous revolutionaries as any Birch Society sympathizer would. His police department, all white and all male, was very hostile toward non-whites, of course, toward Jews from New York, who were regarded as the source of all the problems on campus, very pro-war. But also, as became clear within a year or so, very, very eager to get the overtime that came with supposedly keeping the students at bay and sending in infiltrators to do all kinds of things not long after, to be throwing rocks through windows and so forth, because overtime was great. And I know this from many places, but mainly from the former chief of the fire department, earlier chief of the Firemen's Union, Firefighters Union, who watched all of it up close and testified to the level of moral corruption in the police force. But you could say financial corruption, too, because riots are good for them. So I didn't learn about this stuff until much later, but I could tell that a decisive moment, a decisive change had taken place on campus. And as the issue of Connections, the underground newspaper, appeared shortly after, and it was just great. It was fabulously informative in ways that even the Capital Times was not whatsoever in relation to the war or the campus scene. I probably took 50 copies into the dorms and gave speeches in the dorms and sat with students and so forth, but mostly marveled at how students had taken things on themselves, undergraduates mainly, also graduate students, in creating their own classes. And then as classes returned, were more serious about the meaning of history than I'd ever known them to be, and in truth, that I've ever known them to be again. It was a marvelous, engaged student population of young people who thought the young people could change the world, and that they had to because they, the male ones, were being drafted to go to this monstrous war.
Thank you for that, Paul. I think you mentioned this in your article, but did you know the people who were in charge of Connections?
I must have met them very, very shortly, because we did the printing of Radical America was in the back room of the Connections office. That's exactly how I knew them.
Okay.
The one sheet printing press. But Robert Gabriner was, a great presence on campus, and I remember going to a party at his house. He was the central figure in Connections, and his poetry editor was a fellow named Dave Wagner, whose wife worked on the History of Wisconsin series with Mary Jo, that is Grace Wagner, and Dave Wagner and I became instant, really good friends and remained so ever since. He taught me about poetry, and I taught him about Marxism, so we probably were equal to each other. So I was meeting people and understanding what organizing is very, very quickly in the fall of 1967, and immensely appreciative of the opportunity to do so.
Paul, I want to shift gears slightly, although I think it relates. You talk about students being engaged and your history classes being as rich as they ever were or ever would be. But specifically when you came here, who did you come here to study under, or did you
know?
Well,
there's the problem. Professor A. William Hoagland, as Mary Jo and I were completing our MAs, said to us, now it's time for you to go home. Home always meant at UW and Madison. So we did. Would we have thought of it otherwise? Maybe not so clearly, but everyone was accepted. There was no difficulty getting into school. I didn't have a TA the first semester. No, I had an RA. That is to say, I worked in the Historical Society archives, processing the papers of a union, which was just great. Wonderful meeting the people in there and learning more about how to process archival material, et cetera, et cetera. What we thought of as the great professors, with one exception, had already fled, which is to say retired. Curdy and a handful of others, they were no longer professors, although they mostly stayed in town. But the one exception was William Appleman Williams. Now, and I was able to take one course with him before he departed, but that made an immense impression on me, as he did on everybody else. I really was talking about U.S. history, because European history meant George Mossy and Harvey Goldberg. I didn't actually take a class from Goldberg, but I met with them off and on. George Mossy had as much impact on me as on thousands of other people. At any rate, I was in a seminar led by Paul Glad, who was a sort of milk and water liberal, an okay fellow, but in the seminar was Frank M. Spock and a number of other people who I would know most of the rest of my life. So that this is the important point, and I'm sorry I didn't get to it directly. Our association, collectively speaking, with professors, especially in the American side, was rather weak. But our presence as graduate students in an enormous graduate student class, the largest it would ever be at UW, was intense and rich. Instead of competing with each other, as I suppose graduate students are expected to be, we were a very large, very rich, very left-leaning community. So that within that community, we had all the resources that we wanted. And if we picketed buildings and had little respect for professors who crossed the picket lines, in general, and there weren't too many in history at any rate, in general, we were a world of graduate students unto ourselves.
Okay, so just to make sure I'm hearing you right, so it's really your cohorts, your graduate students, were really the more than the professors, the graduate students were.
One more, with Williams the exception, U.S. history, Mossy and Goldberg the exception. And there were some other outstanding professors, but I just was focused on mainly on U.S. history and working on my chosen subject and engaged in publishing a magazine and all those picket lines and TAA meetings and all the other things that were going on.
So what did you choose to... well, first off, I think I read that you came here with an MA. Is that correct?
I came with an MA. My MA was on Louis C. Fraina, Fraina, / Louis Corey, the name he later took. He was the most avant-garde character in the Socialist Party milieu of Social Labor Party milieu of Daniel DeLand, the crossover into the proto-communist left of the later 1910s. He'd also edited Modern Dance magazine and was a working class Italian American who was sui generis in many ways and rushed to the Soviet Union in the early 20s, and then various bad things happened to him, and he reemerged at Louis Corey in the 30s, a prominent economist, but he was on his way to being a fanatical anti-communist. And in many ways, the huge promise of his youth ending up being disappointing to himself and everyone else was the story of the decline of the American left from its pre-1920 status, which remains my sentimental favorite, to the deadness of the 1950s that I grew up in, with interesting things happening in many stages in between, but with that sense of decline as a melancholy note in the MA thesis that I wrote. But my intent had always been to have something broader and to write the history of Marxism in the United States. And that was what I was thinking about from the first moment I got to campus in 1967.
So I should know this, but how did the Marxism in the U.S., how did that then turn into the dissertation?
No, as I said, a very, very good question, but a complex question. Mary Jo Buell wrote a dissertation more or less about women in American socialism, and then looking at it with an eye to writing a monograph, started over again, research, but because the dissertation form was displeasing or not what we had in mind. Much the same with me. I completed the dissertation in 1975, but at that time, many U.S. historians were realizing the limitations of the English language, and I was realizing, although late to realize, that most of the members of the Socialist and Communist parties had been immigrants, European immigrants, and that most of the newspapers published for those parties had been published in non-English languages. Now, there were real limitations. I was never going to learn Finnish or Hungarian or Russian. But I could take a dive at German. I had been a C student in high school and college, never outstanding. And from German, I could migrate toward Yiddish, which is High Middle German written in a Hebrew script or Aramaic script and reading right to left. And as a youngish social historian, the idea of discovering these new things and reading newspapers that nobody had read for 60 years seemed very exciting. And so that's how I concluded my time with my dissertation, thinking this just isn't good enough even as I do it, and then moved on to a wider sense, which, darn it, took me another 10 years to work on. But out of which all of the excess knowledge that I acquired in the meantime by founding the Oral History of the American Left in 1976 at New York University, out of that came the Encyclopedia of the American Left, published in 1990, which is sort of like the grand version of my dissertation, only it's 1,000 pages and has 60 authors.
Paul, thank you for that. I think for a couple reasons, this may be a good point to wrap up for the day.
Good.
I want to thank you for your time. I want to chat briefly after I turn off the recorder.
Very good.
Paul, thank you for your time today, and this concludes the first oral history interview with Paul Buell. Today is May 19th, 2014. This is the follow-up interview with Paul Buell. Again, this is a phone interview. We are both in Madison at two separate locations. That's why it's called a phone interview. And Paul, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure. Paul Buell, last name spelled B-U-H-L-E.
Great. Thank you. So, as I said before we turn the recorder on, have like 6 or 7 questions over the next 50 minutes. We'll see how far we get. So the first one is, what was Professor Williams like to work with?
Well, my actual work with him was limited in the sense that I was able to take one course. It was an undergraduate survey course in modern diplomatic history, but it also had a section for graduate students. And the way that we were differentiated from undergraduates was that we needed to do a longer research paper, and that meant coming into his office and chatting with him. This was significant for several ways for me. The first one was that he was really affable and kindly, and not with me, not grouchy at all, as he could be sometimes, maybe when he was hungover, but also that we don't talk about my research paper, whatever kinds of research I was doing. But I also asked him about a grant for my magazine, Radical America, and the place that I knew was giving grants to left-wing activities, socially critical activities and publications, that is to say, the Rabinowitz Foundation. And he said he would write a letter to them. And indeed, this very small and financially hard-pressed publication got $1,000 from them, which meant a whole lot in 1968 or 69, whatever year that came through. So in many ways, it was wonderful listening to him in class. The class was huge, and he was a wonderful lecturer and all those things. And secondly, he welcomed me as a publisher of a magazine, Succeeding Studies in the Left, you might say, but also as a young person who was politically serious and also scholarly about the task of researching and writing history.
Great. Thank you, Paul.
Are you bothered at all by this, by any background noise?
No. To me,
I can hear it, but I think it's only temporary.
Okay. To me, all I can hear is...
Don't close doors away.
All right. To me, I can only hear you. So.
Very good.
And I think in a subsequent interview, probably our last interview, we'll talk more about your book, about Williams, but I think we'll leave that for a subsequent interview. So, Well, maybe we'll start this. Maybe we'll start this way then. We want to talk a little bit about your teaching and research experience. Maybe we'll start by asking. So, what do you recall the paper that you had to write for that class?
Boy, I wish I did. It may have been finding a document and in diplomatic history, and then analyzing it. You know, reprinting such as we did, probably typing it out or making a Xerox or something, and then reprinting it. I mean, then writing a 500-word commentary. That's probably the only thing that I can think of that it might have been.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about your teaching, if any, that you did in graduate school.
Sure. Well, maybe it's easier to start with the historical society stuff, because that was my first semester, I believe, at UW in the fall of 1967. And that would have been working in the fourth floor of the Historical Society, Wisconsin State Historical Society, then researching, not researching, processing papers of a union that was seeking to organize successfully in the South in the 1940s. That would be one of the textile unions. And it was a great job because the other archivists were serious about history. There was a former victim of the blacklist who'd been able to, was a local left-wing guy who was able to get a job at the Historical Society, which he wouldn't have been able to otherwise in many parts of the state or private employment. I did not that I spoke with him, but people talked about him. And my supervisors were very kindly, and I learned some important details of processing papers, constructing dates, trying to figure out what the last names of writers of letters were, if you didn't have the last names, all the sort of stuff of how do you work with documentation, paper documentation, and make it usable by future patrons. So that was just great. By the second semester, but more likely by the second year, by the fall of 1968, I was cheerfully plunged into the classroom as a teaching assistant. And it was perfectly fine. It was a fascinating time to be a teaching assistant because there was still so much ferment on campus from the previous year, the Dow demonstration, the police riot, and the subsequent strike and so forth. And I tried to blend 20th century history U.S. into the present in the sense of asking students to respond to the question, what did they know historically a year later about the Dow incident? How did they understand some part of current history? And they had all kinds of different views and opinions, and also they had a sense of their own participation in a historical event, which is quite an unusual sort of thing for an 18-year-old to take on. But it made history seem a great deal more interesting and intimate than it would normally, and then they could project backward in a better or more interested fashion as to how one might understand historical events and personalities in the past. That's my largest memory of that class, but it was as through my all my teaching in Madison 1968 to 71, the students were just excellent, better than I've ever known since, and they felt that they were changing history or might change history, and so history meant more to them that history would mean subsequently in my teaching career.
So a couple of questions about your teaching then. So was it primarily 20th century U.S. history?
It was entirely 20th century U.S. history.
Okay. And who, so you TA'd, did
I should amend that by saying that it might have been post-Civil War to the present, so a bit, 30 years of 19th century history. And who were my, who did I TA for? At least once, it was for William O'Neill, but once I'll need to consult my wife.
Who was Paul Richards, the professor of the economic historian?
Mort Rothstein.
Mort Rothstein. Okay, thank you.
Bit of an economic historian, yes, he was entirely an economic historian, I'm corrected to say.
Okay.
I would say was... enjoyed being gruff. He was a former longshoreman, so he liked being difficult, but actually he was pretty much okay, and William O'Neill was surrounded by young radical students in his classes and eager not to offend them, so So all in all, I had a very pleasant time.
Okay. Do you recall any undergraduates that you taught that you ended up finding out more about later on, becoming friends with?
Of all those, I would say Leo Burt would be the only exception. Leo Burt being the only person from the Army Math Research Center bombing that never turned up and we presume is dead. Other than that, did I later find out anything about my undergraduates? Yes, I'm quite incorrect. There's a labor historian in Pennsylvania whose name does not occur to me, and I might not be able to find it, but he's worked on environmental effects in the workplace, and he most definitely was an undergraduate student of mine.
Okay. And so are you saying that you taught Leo Burt, but really it was after the fact that you...
Of course. Of course. No, my recollection, as I've often said since then, is that in the spring of 1970, it was William O'Neill had a course on radicalism, which was quite a chaotic course because it was so huge, and his knowledge of the subject wasn't comprehensive. But we were very energetic teaching assistants, including Mary Jo, who's probably had the best group of undergraduates because they wanted to learn about women's history. It was very exciting and new. Leo Burt was the columnist for the Cardinal on sports, and he seemed to be politically sympathetic, but not deeply political, and probably wasn't involved in any kind of student organization or anything. He was a sort of average young enthusiast who was capable of doing the wrong or at least the very foolish thing because the war was grinding on and tens and hundreds of thousands were being killed for no reason. Did I know anything about his involvement with these other people? No, nothing whatsoever. He just appeared in class and he spoke up sometimes, not a lot, but he seemed like an affable kid, and that's my entire Leo Burt experience.
Okay, thank you for that. So you talked last time about it was really your cohorts, your graduate students that you had the closest bonds with, and I'm not sure I asked you specifically which ones influenced your life the most, so I wonder if you would talk a little bit about some of your cohort.
Happy to do so. Well, before Barry Joe and I moved to Madison in late August 1967, Jim O'Brien, a real central figure in SDS and still a leading figure in Historians Against War to this very day, had been in touch with me. I think he also was involved in this project of internal education in SDS, and consequently, when he heard that I was seeking to launch a magazine that would be directed mostly to SDSers, he was quite interested. He met with me at a summer conference of some kind, so we were already in touch, and as I got there, he arranged for a place for Murray Joe and I to stay a couple nights until we got an apartment, which was, in fact, the rented house on next to the railroad tracks, where Henry Hoslock and his wife, of course, Francis Court, really falling apart shacks next to the railroad tracks, but quite accommodating in some ways. The screens weren't very comprehensive against flies or mosquitoes, but leaving that detail aside, I was instantly, Mary Jo, too, welcomed into this graduate student world. Henry Hoslock, a leading figure in the TAA effort, was a math graduate student, so I didn't really know him very well except that he was around and had been a leading figure in SDS. He was sort of easing out of that into the TAA work. But Jim O'Brien was, from that moment, and would continue to be through our lives in Madison and our early time in Somerville, a real central figure. He was willing and eager to do anything in terms of the footwork that needed to be done, and eager for a conversation about what might be done in internal education. And I believe not only did he run a couple of study classes, one notable one on labor within SDS or among graduate students that included SDS sympathizers, more graduates than undergraduates, but if I'm not wrong, he'd actually arranged the publication of a couple of pamphlets by Madison SDS the year previous. So he was the energetic center of graduate self-education through real reading and discussing existing scholarly works and
trying to make radical sense of them in some kind. There are a host of other radical-minded history graduate students, most not all in U.S. history, that we were closely in touch with. A larger number were European history, Goldberg, Mossy students, and so forth. But the ones we knew best, were likely to know best, were in U.S. history. And at least at that moment, the one that appeared immediately to me, also went to SDS meetings, was Anne Gordon, who later would play a prominent role in the papers of women suffrage leaders, but was a very skillful, determined activist who was wonderful to talk with about these serious subjects, and for a while was editor of the newspaper of Connections after Robert Gebrehner and its other founders left town. So she was a real central person in many ways, and I can't think of anyone else besides herself and Jim O'Brien, who were SDSers, graduate students, who were so much on top of what was going on.
Well, since you mentioned SDS a couple of times, Paul, I wonder if you could talk about your involvement with SDS here.
Well, it's an interesting question, because back in Madison, as I think we covered, back in Champaign, as I think we covered in an earlier conversation, SDS chapter was so new and so relatively small that I plunged into it in the fall of 1965 and became a spokesman for it very shortly. The SDS chapter, University of Connecticut in Storrs, was so limited, unsuccessful in a campus of commuter students, that if I could create an event with a popular speaker, that would be a big deal, but the chapter didn't really function very well. It was one of those very weak chapters. By contrast to that, the chapter in Madison was very, very large and vital from the moment I stepped in. And I was happy to be there and happy to speak and around and discuss things with these students, but I didn't find myself particularly necessary. There were plenty of people who were much better speakers than I who would stay late for these very long meetings discussing anti-war strategies in the ballroom of the union. And my role was sort of seemed to be to take a step back and publish the magazine Radical America while being active with everybody else in more or less important, limited ways in the TAA effort and all the other things that were going on campus. So, you know, I would describe myself at this stage in Madison as a fairly average graduate student within SDS, because in a successful campus, SDS was overwhelmingly undergraduate students, and the graduate students were these older people who came around but didn't want to impose themselves or dominate the activity of what was going on. And the other crucial factor is that in some campuses there had been almost no political activity on the leftward side until SDS. That certainly was true in Illinois, and it certainly was true in Connecticut, but in Madison, the anti-war peacenik activity directed toward campus and directed toward the community was long-standing, pretty significantly popular, and so SDS was a latecomer, and its role was valuable, but only within this very much larger mix of events on campus.
Thank you, Paul. I'm just jotting down a note here. So, you mentioned earlier about, you know, discussions you would have with Henry Hazlick or Jim O'Brien or some of your other cohort. Where would these discussions take place?
I have one more footnote on that last question.
Okay.
Because it just occurs to me.
Okay.
In later years, I happened to be on a train with Evan Stark between New York and New Haven, and he remarked to me that SDS had been created in quotes, on the campus in Madison because the Committee to End the War in Vietnam was at loggerheads with itself. It had been divided between people who thought it was necessary to work within the Democratic Party locally and people who thought it was terrible to work within the Democratic Party locally. and that would be people who were sympathetic toward the broad sort of popular front descended from the Communist Party a long time earlier, and the people who were close to the Socialist Workers' Party, the Trotskyists, who opposed anything within the Democratic Party. But these people had been sort of arguing with each other, mostly in a friendly way, for at least 5 years on campus, and they were directed outward toward the community more than campus itself. Someone perceived the need for a group of undergraduates who were free of this older set of arguments and were directed specifically toward campus. And according to his account, other people had encouraged the creation, or you might say recreation, of an SDS chapter, because SDS had existed intermittently on the UW campus from its founding in 1961, but had never been central in any way whatsoever. And now it was going to be very important, if not necessarily central, between 1967 and 1969. But it may be important in the way that mainly that it transcended the limitations of earlier anti-war activities. That's my footnote.
Okay.
Now, what was the next question?
The question was, you referenced earlier in the graduate student question about having discussions with some of your cohorts, and I'm wondering where these discussions took place.
Before and after SDS meetings at the Union, most definitely at discussion groups that Jim O'Brien had convened on labor history and other subjects. Corporate liberalism would be another example of people discussing something, and there was another study circle of on Marx and Marxism that I wasn't part of. But mainly, I think people ran into each other in the Historical Society.
Okay, so like the reading room of the Historical Society?
Yeah, I think so. Or, you know, in other words, not to disturb anyone else, walking outside if the weather was okay and having a chat, or stepping over into the Memorial Union.
Okay, thank you. So since we're talking about Memorial Union, and you mentioned... Well, you mentioned Memorial Union, so I want to talk about a little bit more about the Rathskeller.
Uh-huh.
And what you might see as its importance in terms of student activism on campus.
Well, since many a young person came to Madison from out of state, or at least as far as Illinois would be concerned, like myself, although I wasn't an undergraduate, the appeal of beer in the Rathskeller definitely seems to have been an historical factor. But I think that the Rathskeller in chilly weather and the Terrace in warm weather were places that young anti-war people would not only mix with each other, but also mix with their professors. I always had this impression that Harvey Goldberg would gather a group of students around, let's say on the Terrace, and would hold court, and that he wasn't the only one. This was a place outside of the classroom, anywhere in the Union, any of those three places in the Union, where professors who were popular and charismatic and so forth would sort of carry on the Socratic dialogue and be enjoyed greatly, and the students loved to respond to them, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't happen to be part of any of those circles, perhaps because we graduate students were a world unto ourselves, but I knew that they existed.
Okay. Another place that the book Rads, Bates in the book Rads, mentions a lot as a place where people would get together and talk about things was the Nitty Gritty, and I'm wondering if you personally ever hung out there.
No. There's a wonderful anecdote somebody sent me about the Madison left in the 1950s around studies in the left. It was Michael Lebowitz, who was still around and was part of the study circle, and he said James Weinstein was unique among us because he lived away from campus and had a car, which is to say, in the period just before Mary Jo and I arrived, everybody lived near campus and nobody had a car. Madison had just reached the stage where people were living in the East Side, where the East Side came to be seen as a viable place to live. I don't think anybody lived anywhere else. Somebody occasionally would hear about renting a house west of the of the city, but in Middleton, somebody I one of fellow graduate student actually did, but that was considered bizarre. Nobody had actually been to Middleton. And likewise, Verona and all these other places. Oh yeah, one other graduate student, Peter Wiley, lived in Sun Prairie, which was a very small town, because he owned a dog and wanted to have a house with a yard. But these were unique circumstances. By the time we moved to Spade Street, other graduate students had just moved to the east side. And so consequently, the world that had existed was very small, and the nitty-gritty and before it, Glenn and Ann's, I think maybe Glenn and Ann's closed in 1966 and changed the nitty-gritty. Mary Jo and I heard Muddy Waters sing at the nitty-gritty to an afternoon crowd of under 30, which was terribly embarrassing to all concerned. But we didn't hang out on campus or in campus areas. We tended to go back home and continue our work from there. And people lived closer in, which would include Jim O'Brien and his friends, very definitely went to the nitty-gritty when they didn't go to the 602.
Okay.
Which tended to be as important as the nitty-gritty, maybe more so. And likewise, the Green Lantern, which had showed old movies and left-wing students worked real jobs there, but had some kind of cultural events in the evenings. So as in all other circumstances, I would look with some skepticism about the generalizations in RADS, because factually speaking, the author was often wrong.
Thank you. So Paul, I want to hit on your memories, if any, of a couple of other major pre-Sterling Hall events.
Uh-huh.
Well, first is the Democratic Convention in Chicago in 68.
Uh-huh.
Did you attend?
Tom Hayden, this is a curious memory, and I toss around now and then. In the spring, maybe April or May, he came to campus in order to try to get people to come, to plan to come for the Democratic Convention, and might even have been June. And he seemed to be saying to some people that it was possible to get a peacenik nominee, and therefore it would be a great idea to come. And he seemed to be saying to other people that it was impossible to get a peacenik nominee, and therefore we should come to demonstrate. And between the two of those, I think Mary Jo and I felt that this was going to be a heavy action scene with a lot of potential violence. And we happened to be vacationing in New England, wondering why we weren't in Chicago, I suppose. But we weren't on the scene. And quite a few people from Madison did go down for it, but I wasn't one of them.
Okay. So that was the summer of 68. And then, so fall or academic year 68, 69, then had the Black Strike.
That's right.
In early 69.
Right.
With the seeds of it sort of in late 68.
Uh-huh.
Did you have any involvement in that?
Of course, I and every other TA went on strike, but we felt, as everyone felt, that tactically, strategically, that it was a terrible mistake. It was badly planned. It was rather announced suddenly. It could have been conducted with far more success, and it wasn't quite a debacle, but it was the first step backward, following one success after another in terms of mobilization, what it meant to have a strike, what it meant to have effective picket signs, what it meant to win over semi-sympathetic faculty members, or at least make them feel as if they shouldn't cross the picket line, etc. The mobilization of students was much more problematic than a war issue, of course, but it wasn't all that, in my recollection, all that successful. And like everyone I knew, we honored it, but we felt that it wasn't a success.
Okay. So we'll jump ahead then to the next year, which the TAA strike.
Uh-huh.
In the spring of 1970. I'm assuming you're TAing at that point.
Indeed. And in that case, it was in one sense one of the most dramatic events that I ever experienced on a campus. In fact, in every sense, the most dramatic event I ever experienced on a campus, for several reasons. One was that students in some ways took over their own lives in dormitories. They took on the responsibility of educating themselves, as well as forming their own undergraduate committees to do all sorts of things related to the strike, but were extremely sympathetic to the strike in very large numbers, and more than that, were energetic and interesting and humorous. And, you know, it made for me foreshadow the events of the uprising of spring 2011 because of the mass character of the participation and the good humoredness of the participants. But it's also true that it was extremely well planned. The TAA was very, very effective, right up to the point to what do we do when the university has made clear that they were willing to give in on questions of conditions for teaching assistants, but they were absolutely unwilling to give a single inch in terms of educational reform, which meant that the graduate students would get what we wanted and the undergraduates would not get what they were seeking. It was quite a tense moment. One question was whether teaching assistants should now sit in or take some other kind of nonviolent direct action, which could get a lot of people thrown out of the university and could very well, if we had stepped into a trap, destroy the TAA, or was it time to make a tactical decision to take what we could get and, you know, hope for better next time around? There's several ironies here, and that is several universities, but most notably Brown University, avoided some of the worst of the conflicts by giving into educational reform, and it turned out to be vastly successful. It was a calling card for education for students to go to Brown within 2 or 3 years. But the faculty and the administration at UW were foolishly obdurate, many professors felt their dignity had been insulted in the previous 3 years, in the way that professors can be terribly foolish and egotistic in this respect. And the administration also was unable to respond in a flexible and intelligent way, no doubt pushed by the Board of Regents. So that the TA strike was very effective in terms of student support, in terms of the TAs ourselves, at least within liberal arts and math and some other places. And a union was successfully created, the first one in the nation, which was quite an accomplishment indeed. And a degree of labor sympathy and support with the larger community was created, despite the absolute hostility of the leaders of the Madison Central Labor Council, that is to say, the very reactionary and racist building trades. Some of this is recounted in the SDS comic and also in a book that Barry Jo Buell and I put together called It Started in Wisconsin. There's a reflection on that strike back there and what it meant in labor terms with the Teamsters coming to support the teaching assistants, a crucial development. So in many, many ways, it was quite successful and remarkable, and it was as fabulous in a positive way as the bombing of the Army Math Research Center would be fabulous in an utterly negative way 6 months later.
Thank you for that, Paul. Could you maybe, not that there was probably a typical day during the strike, but what sort of things would you do during the course of that TAA strike?
Oh, it was very cold most of the days. But since I wasn't in the leadership of the Teaching Assistants Association, putting out Radical America and all the other activities at the time, I think that the Madison Kaleidoscope that Dave Wagner was editing was just about to appear or had appeared, and I was a lead writer for it under various names. So lots and lots of other things to do. But what I did is I walked the picket lines, and in the course of doing that and keeping our hands warm and so forth, spent a lot of time talking to other people. And I just did my duty as a union member and wouldn't claim more than that, except that I would take every opportunity I could to go in the dorms and talk. And again, as in the aftermath of the police riot at Dow, it was a great moment for students to educate themselves and invite graduate students in to chat with them about what the situation situation was, what this had to do with the Vietnam War, and a whole series of other issues that were of concern to them.
Thank you. So that the TAA strike ended almost on the heels of then Nixon's press conference about bringing the war, well, announcing that the war was in Cambodia, already was in Cambodia, but he made a formal announcement of it.
Yeah.
And then on the heels of the shootings at Kent State and Jackson State. Do you recall, do you have memories or anecdotes about those?
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing is this. When we demonstrated at Dow, the police came in with quite brutally, with clubs and a degree of anti-Semitism and a whole bunch of ways in which they considered themselves to be so much in control of the situation or perhaps psychologically threatened that they overreacted to a huge degree. By way of contrast, at the time of the Kent State massacre, or in the aftermath of it, the National Guard was called to campus, and there were young men in uniforms with heavy-duty weapons. But they were the opposite of the Madison police in 1967. They didn't want to be there. They were more friendly than they were supposed to be, and they were in no danger of using those weapons. Nobody was tear gassed, nobody was shot, etc. So that in a way the rules had been established, at least within that world, at the same time as the Madison Police Department, still controlled by essentially a merger, was involved in cracking down on the marijuana trade while ignoring the heroin trade, putting Madison police into hippie garb, and they would go out and break windows at State Street, and then they would stand around for hours collecting, the uniform police would stand around for hours collecting overtime pay, et cetera, a real degree of political corruption. By contrast to that, the National Guardsmen were unthreatening, on a presence for a few days, but all this was in the wake of Kent State or in relation to Kent State. And I think the horror of the war having come home became more vivid than it had ever been before.
So Paul, during your time here, did you, and I don't recall whether you talked about this during Dow, but did you ever end up being confronted by either Madison Police or the National Guard?
Well, I was at Dow, so I ducked when the club came at me. And Paul Soglin didn't duck as far down as I did, so he got hit on the head. And somebody who'd become one of my closest friends in Providence in the 1970s and 1980s, a guy named Charles Schwartz, had tried to pull a policeman off at beating a co-ed and had been really beaten badly. And a warrant was put out for his arrest. He left town in disguise, never came back to undergraduate school, and so forth and so forth. There's a lot of very bitter memories about that. And by contrast to that, my presence was, benign and so forth. But I want to say one more thing about the earlier question, and that is that by 1970, a large part of blue-collar America was against the war, and that marks a serious contrast to 1967, and we could feel that change on campus.
How, is there a way you can sort of verbalize that?
Well, I would
that?
Say again, if there was an excuse or rationale for the behavior of the police in 1967, it's that they thought of the students as these privileged people who were a bunch of New York Jews and weren't going to have to go to Vietnam and so forth and so forth. In 1970, those National Guardsmen were from blue-collar homes, and they didn't want to be sent to Vietnam either, and they didn't regard themselves. They regarded the rise of youth culture had continued to with music and all kinds of things. So they didn't consider themselves separate and apart from the students. They were just sent there to do something they didn't want to do, but they were almost an extension of ourselves. They just happened to have uniforms on. Whereas in 1967, the line was very clear and marked a lot of hostility. And if there was something in between, of course, it was the Madison firefighters, who were led by a progressive figure who was quite opposed to police misbehavior and would play a central role in pushing Paul Soglin forward to be mayor.
And I can't, do you recall the name of the, I don't have it on the top of my head, the name of the person in charge of the fire department?
Oh, now I'm going to forget.
All right.
Ed, No, it's of course it's in my notes. But
yeah, we have.
You have it.
Yeah, we have it.
Later
I just
became head of the fire department. He was head of the firemen's union in 1967 and 1970, but then later he became head of the fire department. And the sharp division of firefighters versus police plays a central role in the changes culturally and politically in Madison from 1967 to 73.
Okay. I had something. I can't think of what I was going to follow up with. So let's
end now and then pick up later.
Yeah, let me make sure to give you space if there are things on your mind about this time period, and we'll end before Sterling Hall. I don't like to end on Sterling Hall.
Good.
But is there anything on your mind?
I think that the central observation that I have is that in any number of other university communities around the U.S., and despite the fact that graduate students were going toward the east side and forming our own community there, which played a big role, especially in the DAA, nonetheless, the area around campus in general became a sort of student anti-war countercultural zone. You could say a lot more marijuana was being smoked in that district than in the rest of the city, and that would be accurate. But you could also say that the sentiment on the streets was very anti-war and anti-establishment, and yet at the same time able to be organized into voting blocks, most emphatically behind Soglin, but also behind other candidates. What had happened was those areas were increasingly occupied by students because the student population was rising so fast that people who lived there before didn't want to pay higher rents. Rents were suddenly higher. So they left. Some of them continued to vote. Most of them didn't bother to vote. But the students in the middle 60s couldn't vote, and people under 21 couldn't vote. So just as the laws were changing, allowing the 18-year-old vote, likewise, Paul Soglin and others were organizing the students to be able to vote and to actually vote, so that this was a campus area which was anti-war, counterculture, and beginning to play a real political role in the city. That's what happened that I observed from the distance from the east side, that I could see was playing a very important role in the evolution of Madison politics and Madison culture. Very much resisted and resented by old-style Republicans, but pretty much resisted and resented by Cold War Democrats who wanted the city to be run by the same old real estate crowd, whether they called themselves either Republicans or Democrats, and certainly resisted the rise of Paul Soglin, Eugene Parks, and a group of other progressives, but were beaten back by sheer skill of organization. I didn't observe so much of this myself, because it was really taking place as Mary Jo and I were preparing to leave. But by the time we came back for the first summer to do research in 1973, we could see that a lot of it had already taken place and was consolidating itself, and the city was quite different in 1974 than it had been in 1967, and in many, many ways, a far more democratic place.
Paul, I remembered what I was going to ask, so if you have a couple of minutes.
Sure.
I don't recall whether I asked you this, but in the first interview, but as a young white male, I feel compelled to ask you about the draft and the importance of it in being either on campus or before campus as a young man in the 60s.
Yeah. Well, I had been called to a pre-induction physical in New Haven 6 months before getting to Madison, and I was finally given a 1Y as being politically dangerous or undesirable or something like that, like thousands of others of my type. So it was the central issue at the time, but not central to me personally. I was not going to be drafted. But from the time I got to campus until the time I left, the anxiety of young men with the prospect of being drafted, but no less the anxiety of young women of knowing boyfriends, uncles, family, cousins, and so forth, about that mirrored the growing horror at learning what the U.S. was doing in Vietnam. Those two were bound together. and they created an atmosphere which had never existed, even though the Korean War was unpopular on campus, and everybody was afraid to speak up against it because of the FBI and the fear of repression, but also shaped a great deal that was entirely positive because people were looking for something that wasn't the death society, but was some different way to look around and live and be different as a new generation.
So, Paul, this will wrap up today,
okay.
And then I'm just going to end this, and then we can chat for a couple minutes if you don't mind.
Sure.
So this concludes the follow-up interview with Paul Buell. Paul, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
Respond or speak a little bit about the questions that John raised?
Okay.
Or do you want to do something else first?
Well, let's do a quick introduction, and then John can actually raise those questions.
Okay,
we have
very good.
On the recording.
Very good.
All right, so today is the 10th of June, 2014. This is the third interview with Paul Buell. We're actually here at the University Club. Paul and I are actually side by side for the first time in these sessions, and with us too is John Tortorici. So John, before we turned on the recorder, you had a couple of questions you wanted to make sure we asked, so why don't we start with those?
Okay. I was interested in how the new left in Madison in the 60s conceived of its political engagement. Was it an attempt to build a viable political movement that engaged with other groups in the culture, labor? I know there were attempts. Was it naive and politically naive in particular, and more interested in a kind of psychological or emotional throwing up of anger and resentment at parents, at culture, at politics? I mean, was there any figure? And in, you know, I'm kind of, this is a leading question, but I was
quite a leading question.
In Mossy, in, you know, who always claimed that he attempted to. That he was very sympathetic towards the students, but he attempted to get them to think about a long-term political engagement that was viable, but that also understood all of those insights that he had developed in the course of his explorations of
mm-hmm.
politics and
mm-hmm.
symbolism and
mm-hmm.
you know, myth, and that came out of his own history from
mm-hmm.
the 30s and 40s. So just an overview of
mm-hmm.
how the New Left conceived of itself as a political movement and whether it did have any theoretical interest or engagement.
Well, I think the most important thing is to see how distinct two or more likely three generations were involved from the founding of Studies in the Left in 1959 on the campus of UW to the founding of Radical America in 1967. Same campus, and then to the departure of Radical America from the campus in 1971, by which time, over a period of 4 years, things had changed very drastically again. Studies in the Left was formed by a group of intellectuals who were mostly graduate students, and in the beginning were a scattering of different sorts of intellectuals, but most of them were historians, and a few, like James O'Connor, who was a sociologist, regarded them as odd people out because mostly it was historians. The older ones among them, notably James Weinstein, who had the money, his father having been a grocery store entrepreneur of major means on Cuba, who as an old communist sort of cheerfully gave up those grocery stores, but still had quite a bit of money, and so James Weinstein had what no one else had around that studies group, which is money to publish a very respectable-looking journal, more professional and respectable and journal-looking than Radical America would be able to achieve on virtually no money. It was said in 1959 or 1960 that James Weinstein was unique among the editors of Studies in the Left because he lived so far from campus that he owned a car. Madison was a smaller place in those years, and to own a car was to be unusual, and be off the campus. So Studies in Left formed, and in its first issue it described, quote unquote, the radicalism of the disclosure. That is, they had, most of them, broken away from some section of the Communist Party or its youth movements. Weinstein had been a communist, and several other people had been in the Young Communist League on the campus of UW in the mid-1950s and had become disillusioned with the Hungarian Revolution and the Khrushchev revelations of 1956. But they had a background in the old left. They had heard that there was a new left, calling itself the new left, founded in Britain in 1956, led by the great historian E.P. Thompson and peace leader, and they wished to follow in its wake. Actually, even by 1957 or 58, there were new left clubs in four or five cities of the United States. And a magazine called The American Socialist, with its roots in Trotskyism, was seeking to encompass some new left and find some new point of departure that wasn't the discredited communist, wasn't the hopelessly sectarian communist, wasn't the fuddy-duddy socialist as far as they existed or any other existing thing, but what they wished to call a new left. Inspired by Britain, but hoping to find a new generation of radicals in the U.S. So they had detached themselves from anything that could be considered orthodox Marxism. They didn't believe in the grandeur of the proletariat seizing power in the immediate future. And in fact, the central ideas of Studies in the Left, of James Weinstein and others, were circling around the notion of the corporate state. How the New Deal that had seemed to most people in the old left, communists in particular, to be the best thing that America had ever come up with, was in fact a partner, a marriage partner with corporate America. And while it dispensed great deals of social welfare, it also locked itself into a corporate agenda. It sought to produce students ready to work in the corporations, as university presidents of that time proclaimed. And it had its precursive origins in Woodrow Wilson and the progressivism, which at the time of World War I linked social progress with the American empire and with the spread of American corporate power around the planet. So that Studies in the Left and among its notables on campus had been those who attended UW, Professor Warren Sussman, early 1950s, Joan Scott also was here, James Gilbert was also here, and several others. The managing editor was a woman whose name escapes me now, but wrote an essay in History of the New Left. And it was very important in the journal as it progressed. But at some point, around 1964, 1965, they mostly moved to New York City. And the journal moved to New York City, took on new editors, and sought a little more openly to embrace the social movement as it developed out of the civil rights movement and the new left. And various new editors, like Staunton Lind, challenged other editors to become more involved in the first stirrings of the anti-war movement and more involved with social movements like SDS. And other editors in its New York phase, like Eugene Genovese, bristled at this. And if you couldn't say that they were interested in Marxist theory as such, you could say they were already deeply steeped in academic life and believed in the rigors of producing history and in being socialist intellectuals whose first task was to produce scholarship and whose responsibility to organize things or to be involved with organizers was far less important. So there was a conflict within Studies in the Left over what would be more important, scholarship or engagement with activism. And by 1966, they came to a point of division, and they couldn't maintain the publication anymore. So it folded. And so, after that long introduction, Radical America was founded in part precisely because Studies in the Left had folded. It was consciously or unconsciously, the successor to studies in the left. But it represented a new generation of graduate students, those who were 10 years younger, at least, than the studies in the left crowd. It represented people who had no background in the Communist Party or the Young Communist League or anything. We were too young, and we were never of that ilk. And if it's true that we also were historians, we were coming of age at a time when the social movements were growing very rapidly and the civil rights movement had led to the anti-war movement. And we were casting around, trying to provide young people in SDS in particular, since unlike studies in the left, Radical America considered itself part of SDS, an educational arm within SDS. We were trying to provide people a notion of the historical roots of what might become an American left. It wouldn't be very true to say that in the much smaller number of pages in Radical America that there was a lot of room for discussing Marxist philosophy. For instance, although by 1970 there would be special issues on philosophy, or academic debates involving sociology and anthropology and other things which might have appeared in studies in the left among those who were already young professors. In Radical America, there really weren't anybody who was yet a professor, and many of the editors, but also the readership of Radical America, were more inclined to be the fellow who ran the independent bookstore, independent and radical bookstore, near campus almost anywhere. They were people who bridged the division, or sought to bridge a division, between scholarly or, let's say, solid intellectual work on the one hand, and political activism on the other. Studies in the left sort of willfully withdrew from the demands of activism because there wasn't much of it in 1959, and then found itself drawn back into its own collapse, you might say, whereas Radical America started with the idea that there would be a bridge between activism and theory, or activism and organized knowledge. I think theory still implied a higher realm of people sitting in a room discussing Adorno or something. And there certainly were people within the Radical America orbit who loved to discuss Adorno, but they didn't write much about it in Radical America. That would be the best way to put it. And there was exactly one person who was on the editorial or advisory editorial board of both publications. And that person was a very favorite student of George Mossy, that is, Paul Brynäs. There weren't any other direct connections, although several other people who either edited issues or were editorial advisors included Stuart Ewan, for instance, David Gross, another person who could be called a Mossy student, though he was in German history. And
he's a Mossy PhD.
A Mossy PhD, right. And several other people wrote or edited or took part who had taken courses from George Mossy and regarded his contribution to their knowledge as, you know, very significant. I'm getting long-winded here, but I'm trying to come to the question of did the New Left have theory? The best answer for that is that the generation that came into the anti-war movement in 1965, you might say with me on the campus of University of Illinois, although I was a little older than most of my fellow undergraduates and had already considered myself a Marxist, whereas they had little background unless their family was from the old left, as it sometimes was in Jewish Chicago and Jewish New York. For the most part, the people who were joining the New Left 1965, 66, 67, 68 were around the age of 20 and had not had time in their life to accumulate anything that could be regarded in a serious or rigorous way as theory. All this stuff was pretty new to them. And events were happening very, very fast. And the other factor is that the New Left was so porous that it differed enormously from campus to campus and city to city. It had no fixed organization, and contrary to the myths about Students for a Democratic Society, on many campuses, SDS did not exist at all, or did not exist until 1968-69, just before it collapsed. SDS tended to fill in the holes that were left, where other organizations hadn't come, or in conservative, or southern, or the religious campuses, it tended to come in late because there was a vacuum and there was no other student organizations that were playing that role, which was substantially simply calling for demonstrations against the war and then trying to organize them and provide slogans. Madison was very unusual because there was this history of intellectualism on campus, because it was an intellectualism that was based in history, contrasting, for instance, to Michigan, where almost everyone was in sociology, contrasted to Columbia, where there was a wide variety of disciplines, but also a sort of rage at being at the most elite university, except for Harvard, and themselves often from very wealthy backgrounds, and therefore literally angry at their parents' milieu sometimes. It would be difficult to find that in Madison. None of us came from wealthy parents. Paul Brindis being the exception, really, maybe Stuart Ewan also. So that Madison was steeped in intellectualism, and at the peak of events, or even before 1967, 68, 69, it wouldn't be at all unusual to find the underground newspaper edited by a history graduate student, Robert Gabriner, who dropped out of history, to have the Teaching Assistants Association, led, if not by the absolute leader, at least those around him, graduate students in history, Ann Gordon being a great example of someone like that, but there were others who were historians, to have Radical America full of historians, the Alternative University, which was very abundant for a couple of years, some of its leading courses were by graduate students in history. And for all of us, and contrary to the slurs against the New Left, we were graduate students, we were teaching assistants, we took ideas seriously. Most of us eventually became academics, but we didn't see it as contrary to our activist roles. If the New Left had lasted even five more years, there would have been much more intellectual work, you can call it theoretical work, that seemed to have some kind of overall connection to the social crisis. But by 1970, except for the women's movement, the gay and lesbian movement, and other movements to come, it was almost all over. So that those who went on to teach and write books largely did so in a vacuum from mass social movements.
So they kind of merged with the academic milieu that they... that their politics came out of, in a sense.
That generation...
Positions on faculty and foundations or whatever. Many kept their engagement in politics, but from a kind of...
Distance,
a protected distance.
That was far, yeah. Far truer for the Studies in the Left generation, okay, than for the Radical America generation. The Radical America generation didn't really have academic jobs until most of them, until the end of the 1970s. So they still lived an extended life as graduate students. And they were involved in such things as the local working class history and education projects, which were part of the Radical History newsletter, the Radical History Organization, and for some years these were kept going in a dozen cities, and they, well, let me go back to Radical America's departure from Madison, because this is a sort of important point here, and then I'll take questions after that, but I want to clarify it. I asked Mary Jo Buell about our departure from Madison, and she said, which took place in August 1971, and she said, well, of course, most of the people in our circle were industrializing. That would be a very great exaggeration. But it is true that when the New Left had reached its apex on campus and was palpably declining, certainly in Madison from that upshot of the Army Math Research Center bombing, there was a swift decline in various kinds of anticipations, movements, and so forth, which we didn't really observe how Paul Soglin was rising and there was a new liberal coalition and his election was 3 years ahead and so forth. That was pretty much unknown to us because we were part of a New Left entity who thought, naively, that since the U.S. was in the midst of the largest strike wave since 1946, a strike wave that contained more non-whites, more women, and more new kinds of places that had never struck before, like the post office workers, that this was the beginning of a working class movement that would take over where the campus movement had failed, or would help to precipitate a broad social movement that included radicalized young people, but also included people from other social classes.
And you have that upwelling that of African American, well, you could say it was in a way a revolt. Some people would say there was a revolutionary aspect to that, but that emerged at that same time.
That's true, and so for Radical America, who published a special issue essentially on black labor, but also on the League of Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit, which for a moment seemed to offer an alternative to the black power, pick up the gun kind of rhetoric, and seemed to be more solidly based in an ordinary working class life, non-white working class life, but it challenged the bureaucratization of unions, especially the United Auto Workers, and it also offered a way forward that had a connection with Marxist ideas. Because if the people around Radical America disdained any kind of return to 1930s communist kind of ideas or Trotskyist kind of ideas, we thought there was something very valuable in Marxism, a way of looking at social class that was important for us, partly because the high phase of the student movement was over. And Radical America then, myself, Mary Jo, and most people around it, made a choice to move to cities that had a connection between university and blue-collar life. This was a great idea for 1971, which seemed to have been a terrible idea by 1974, partly for the reason that those factories closed in very large numbers. We're at the beginning of the Rust Bowl phenomenon, partly because the thought that there would be some kind of breakthrough was extremely naive, and partly because the energy of the new left that remained alive was drained off into these crazy Maoist Marxist-Leninists who would prefer to fight each other than organize some kind of larger movement. But as Radical America tried to maintain the spirit of SDS despite the Marxist-Leninists on one side and weathermen on the other, so there were groups of hundreds of people, numbering perhaps several thousand around the U.S., who had the same mission as we did, to set up camp somewhere between blue-collar and university settings and find a way forward. And there were national conferences, and Radical America might have been the journal or magazine that was sort of the collective expression of those ideas. But that really did fail by 1972 or 1973, and with it, I left Radical America geographically, and the group that took over and maintained it until the year 2000 was largely college teachers in blue-collar colleges in Boston, and community-based activists like Nick Torkelson, who worked in these community groups that were struggling to improve life and hold on to deteriorating conditions.
Well, we could probably talk about these few years for hours on end.
Indeed.
I assume you already spoke of what a fertile ground Madison was for a movement like this to evolve from. You had C. Wright Mills, you had Hans Gerth, you had all of these students that had worked with them that then went on to other universities, Domhoff. Then you had Harvey Goldberg, you had George, you had this such a rich intellectual milieu and a long history of radical politics here.
Yeah.
And it just, but to me, because I do remember something of that period, I came right after the real engaged years of the late 60s. I started in 69, 70, and by then, the Maoists, the Stalinists, the Trotskyists were really coming to, had become the face of leftist
quite right
on campus.
Quite right.
And so I, for me, it was always a kind of romance, that
yeah.
period, and it's how it's remembered a lot by people. But that sense of what it was like to be so empowered, to feel that you could change the world, that you could create a better world,
mm-hmm.
that you had all of this attention and power, and the excitement, you know, both the interpersonal excitement,
mm-hmm.
but just a feel of what it was like to live in that period on
yeah,
campus.
I know I've said this in an earlier interview, but it really bears to me repeating, since it probably is the most evocative experience before the uprising in Madison in 2011, and resembles it in some ways. The month after the police riot at the Dow incident, the strike itself, so ardently supported, at least by liberal arts students, if not engineering students, the eagerness of those students to set up their own classes, to reach out to us graduate students for real knowledge, to come back after the strike and engage with their teaching assistants and sometimes their professors, their yearning to learn things, their hunger to learn things, because they felt as 19-year-olds in 1967 that not only could they change the world, but by God they had to, because they were subject to the draft. Their boyfriends or other relatives were subject to the draft. And it really was a matter of ending the war before something even more horrible happens. And I've just left aside the horrible things that were being done to the Vietnamese. And I think that the warmth of the connection between graduate students and undergraduates was often set off from the coldness between the professordom on the one hand and the graduate students and undergraduates on the other. It's often been said, and even George said it in later years, that the faculty was traumatized by the social movements on campus. But our view was different. We felt that we were traumatized by the war and troubled by our relationship with the professors, whereas from the professors' point of view, they were troubled by the war, but they were traumatized by the students. There's a vast difference between those two standpoints. And to be really uncharitable and leave aside Harvey Goldberg and George and others, you could say, because professors did not support the strike and in many ways were unsupportive and in many other ways accepted strikes and stopped teaching or declined to flunk students who didn't come to classes during those strikes because they were intimidated out of doing it. They and other professors in that era, very large numbers, felt personally terribly insulted when undergraduates would speak up or seek educational reforms. I mean, that one of the great ironies, this is not too much of a diversion, is Brown University, where Mary Jo Buell and I would teach for many years, was transformed from a dullish lower level New England, Ivy League school into a great, wonderful place because the administration accepted the idea of educational reform in the face of student protests on general issues. In Madison, the administration did not accept the idea of educational reform, and indeed, the teaching assistant strike of winter 1971, or winter 1970-71, ended unhappily for undergraduates because the university accepted the union but declined to accept educational reform. So taking nothing away from the classroom ideas that George and Harvey and others put forward, the faculty as a whole was quite sympathetic toward administrators who were personally, quietly against, thought the war was a bad idea. Saying they were against the war would be a little too strong. Thought the war was an unwise idea, but remained faithful to the general vision of liberalism, which included the war, and were horrified by students who had become unruly, and who might for the younger a younger professor cause damage to their careers.
Well, and you have to throw in the contrast with Brown, because Brown's a private school, and UW was under intense pressure
from the state. From the state, and, yes, that's true.
Fred Harrington, who actually was one of our greatest presidents.
A great figure.
Fired.
Yes.
So I think the people that came in were there for a reason, and that is to tamp this all down.
Right.
No reform, and you're right, Scott. I agree completely.
I mean, as I'm writing this or drafting this memoir of Paul Soglin, I come again to the idea that if there had been administrators who were willing to risk their careers, there might never have been a Dow incident. But or if Fred Harvey Harrington hadn't been out of town for the day, to be really hypothetical. But the same thing happened across the country. There were university administrators who were put into a corner and told, if you don't bring in the police to break heads, then you'll never be elevated to be the president of Harvard or someplace. And almost invariably, they chose the police. They were thinking about their own interests, and they weren't thinking about the Vietnamese. They weren't even thinking about we and our undergraduate classes who were going to be drafted and sent into the war. Oh, they were concerned. Naturally, they were concerned. As liberal people, they were always concerned. But they weren't too concerned.
Well, after Fred was fired, they brought in the National Guard, as you know, and we had tanks rolling up and down University Avenue. And the intensity of the repression increased markedly, it seems to me. I remember when you had, you know, these police vans that had these screens on the front that would just charge into the students. And so it got to be a kind of war of attrition in a way.
And this is the phases I discovered through the study of Paul Soglin and in discussion with the head of the firefighters, that the police, the Madison police, employed a considerable group of people who put on hippie clothes, threw bricks through windows, and accelerated the conflict as often as possible, because that way they got to have a lot of double time hours. And we thought of it as a war against the anti-war movement.
It devolved into what would now be considered these online games, it seems.
That's probably so.
It became a kind of cat and mouse.
That's probably so, but for us, as long as bombs were being dropped in Vietnam, it wasn't a game.
Yes. For those people that were politically engaged.
And I also for the leaders of the Madison police, who were very right-wing, the chief inspector was a bircher, it wasn't a game for them either. They saw this as the enemy, and they saw it as cracking down, as increasing their power within the city. And those Madison businessmen who wore the white shoes and played golf with each other on weekends, they too viewed Madison as being taken away from them by these campus radicals. And they certainly meant to put this down, and it wasn't a game for them either.
Right.
And they saw Paul Soglin as a very dangerous figure. George was trying to weave his way through this, and in a way trying to rebuild a Democratic Party that had been terribly damaged by its support for the war, or to put it this way, its unwillingness to support the idea the U.S. should bring the troops home now. The view of David Obie and other Wisconsin Democrats was the war was a terribly bad idea, but we shouldn't speak about it too often because that would damage LBJ. So we'll just sort of wait until a successful election of Democrats, and then the war will be ended in a way in which America will still have honor. For us, that was a completely unacceptable idea. Too many people were dying. So those are real divisions that could not be overcome by pleasant words or good feeling.
So you alluded to Army math, and we didn't get to talk about Army math last time. So I'm wondering, I mean, rarely do things have a simple answer, but I'm wondering what Army math had, what the effect of Army math was on the intellectual or the new left movement, as opposed to, you know, we talk about it tamping down to student protest in general, but what did it do to the intellectual protest?
Well, it's interesting that neither did it halt the Teaching Assistance Association from organizing successfully on campus. Nor did it halt Paul Soglin's march and that of his allies from the city council to running the city. So contrary to the idea that it was so traumatic that the left was so humiliated that it lost everything, that would be a really mistaken view of the situation in Madison. It was a terrible blow to the peace movement coming at the back of an anti-war referendum, a community-wide anti-war referendum, which had actually passed against the war, to the horror, again, of conservatives, including many conservatives on campus, like the Russian professor, what's his name?
Petrovich,
who was horrified by the idea that the U.S. might lose the war in Vietnam. And there were others like him. The Army Math Research bombing didn't end that, didn't end the well-organized movements, but it did shrink the milieu of activity and threw people off balance. And I suppose you'd say in Madison, it probably increased the desire to go to some other city to do some other kind of organizing, because we felt we were, to a certain degree, at a dead end, even though other things went forward. I mean, 1970 was probably the best year of radical America for me, because we produced something like 8 or 9 really good issues against the background of Army Mass Research Center. We came to the conclusion, which may or may not be true, that because these fellows were talking loudly about their activities in the effort to bomb the Baraboo ammunition depot, talking loudly about it in bars, that any investigative organization would have been foolish not to have understood who they were and what they were doing well before they did it. And those of us who are conspiratorially minded, as I tend to be toward the assassination of Martin Luther King, sort of think that there may have been FBI agents one block behind in a car who knew exactly what these naive four characters were doing. And as in other places in the U.S. at the time, were very perfectly willing to see these things take place because it would strengthen their hand enormously, as it did. Perhaps history isn't like that, and they didn't conspire, but the result was very much to strengthen the hands of those in power, conservatives in power, and doubtless to make it more difficult for all kinds of social movements in Madison for a couple of years anyway, and to allow later historians and journalists like a certain David, who was the son of the famous journalist here. David Marinus, to reconstruct the 1960s in Madison as crazy radicals versus idealistic liberals, which is so far from being the truth that it's a travesty on intellectualism, on history, on Madison, on many other levels. But I would describe that as the accepted version.
The acceptable
and accepted version, because large numbers of people, especially those who hadn't been here, read David Marinus's They Marched in the Sunlight and clucked their tongues and said, yes, the radicals were far too radical in those years. And the university administrators being against the war, how could anybody be thinking the war was a bad idea? How could anybody protest at the university when there were such good administrators?
It's also a kind of absolution for not doing anything.
Of course, they were so extreme you couldn't work with them, and so on and so forth. Yeah, I think that's my viewpoint in all these years later.
John Rayne, if you have other questions, I wanted to ask about the graphic nature.
Oh yes, very good.
Radical America,
very good.
Because it
connects with everything.
Yeah, this is an audio interview, but you have a Studies on the Left, sort of a very traditional looking journal.
Very good.
And then Radical America from a few years later.
Not
a traditional-looking journal.
Indeed. I think there may have been one issue of Studies in the Left, more than one, that had interesting covers, like this cover of an American Eagle to have an issue on imperialism, that sort of thing. But Radical America emerges in 1967 at the moment when the underground press suddenly, practically overnight, has hundreds of thousands of readers. And what is the underground press? It's newspapers started locally on a few basis of a few hundred dollars, often not even with an office, because print runs of tabloids, thanks to technology, had become much, much cheaper. They hardly needed to sell advertising. All they needed to do was go out and get people, a few hundred people, to buy a copy at 25 cents each. The artists of underground newspapers, like the cartoonists, like the writers, and like the layout people, they were all learning these skills themselves. Not many of them had any training whatsoever. So that the appearance of underground newspapers and their vast popularity encouraged an explosion of art. And in some parts of the counterculture, that meant blacklight art and psychedelic art and so forth and so forth. But in my section, it meant finding artists to do cover drawings, working for a while with single sheet printer who printed one sheet at a time, and then we would collate the pages and then staple them and then send them out. And then later, Radical America was printed by an anarchist printing cooperative in Detroit, and they too worked with the cover artist. But in our case, in Radical America, as long as there was a single sheet printer, the printer himself would decide on the coloring of the cover. It was as if every person in the publication of the magazine had a sort of creative contribution, and the printer was never seen as somebody who just happened to be printing. As a matter of fact, for the first several issues, the printer was also the leader of the Teaching Assistants Association, Henry Oslock, who had been also the chairman of SDS. You can see how small these circles really were. And it was printed in the back room of the newspaper Connections with a few spare feet. So as the editor, I looked to find a different artist, or find an artist for every issue. It turns out a number of these artists were, in fact, Nick Torkelson, as I now recall, or they just happened to be a photo that someone had provided us and we did something arty with. Now, in the center of a 1967 issue was one photo, and then in later issues, a series of photos, a whole photo section of Michael Lisi, who was among the outstanding graduate students at the time. Whose student was he? Was he Georgia's student or Harvey's? That I can't remember. But he was, a person who collected...
Harvey.
Harvey student. Yeah. He was a photographer, very skilled photographer, who then, shortly thereafter, collected photos of dead and crazy people across Wisconsin. And that photo book was called...
Wisconsin Death Trip.
Wisconsin Death Trip. So he was a historian, too. He was thinking like an historian. And he went to Chicago during the 1968 demonstrations and gave us a bunch of photos from that, and we printed them on slick paper, and it didn't look very good at all. But it was our idea that a magazine should be, as even a crudely printed and underfunded magazine, should be as artistic as it could be. And another notion closely connected with that was that we took poetry seriously. Some poetry appeared in Studies in the Left to its benefit. Some poetry appeared in left-wing magazines. To my knowledge, that poetry was very often didactic. Workers, rise up, or students, start punching the police with your fists. We never had that view. We didn't think that the cover needed to be didactic. It was supposed to be interesting. And sometimes, like a hand against a wall, it was perfectly, totally non-didactic. It was even abstract. The cover of a 1969 issue printed by somebody called Just Folks Revolutionary Printing Commune, whoever they were, the cover photo was by Jim Hogan, who was a leading reporter for the Capital Times and a close friend of our poetry editor, Dave Wagner. Jim Hogan later became, with his wife, a famous detective story writer, a best-selling detective story writer. So that's the oddball kind of crew that we pulled together. And another great example, this issue has some middle section printed separately from the rest of the issue, of Rabbits by T.L. Chris, a Cleveland poet who was best friends with the much beloved poet of the New Left from Cleveland, who committed suicide of D.A. Levy, committed suicide after leaving Madison and going back to Cleveland. But this 4 pages of his friend T.L. Chris's poets, the last being a poet R.I.P., poet rest in peace, was an homage to D.A. Levy, who we love so dearly and who could not be called didactic in any way whatsoever. So that's the kind of enriched milieu in which art and poetry were no more separated from us, we thought, than serious scholarship was separated from us, we thought, than going on the picket line for the Teaching Assistants Association was separated from us. It was all very, very rich. And as you say, it was a source for instant nostalgia since it disappeared so quickly. It went by so fast with our youth.
Maybe just to bring this forward in a sense, so your interest in graphic art didn't end with Radical America.
That's correct. And I left Radical America in 1973 because I was leaving Somerville, where it was published, and Cambridge Goddard Graduate School, where I taught 2 years. I then, 3 years later, founded a once-a-year magazine called Cultural Correspondence, which had very little luck in getting subscribers, less than Radical America. It just happened to lose less money every issue than Radical America, since it was published so infrequently. That was okay, which lasted for 7 years. Mostly in my hands. But it also had a lot of illustrations, comics, various kinds of experimental art, and finally, Cultural Correspondence was taken over by an art activism documentation group started in New York City called PADD, Political Art Documentation and something else, set up as an art group around the ideas of anti-war, the next wars, and supporting the women's movement and abortion and gay rights and so forth and so forth. And finally, the magazine sort of had its last issue was a publication for PADD. So the art impulse was always there, even when it wasn't directly in my hands. And then by the 1990s, I developed the aspiration of publishing art books. Now, actually, in 1983, I had edited something called Labor's Joke Book, which was contained a lot of little tiny book, which contained a lot of labor cartoons, and a certain concern for what had been funny and useful in labor art in the U.S. But by 1999, I believe, I had begun publishing books like Images of American Radicalism, a great big album book of images of various kinds, the insurgent art of Mike Alowitz, a four-color book of a leading left-wing muralist, Mike Alowitz, and I was going on from there, sort of haphazardly. In fact, I published with my friends a couple of books in Rhode Island that were pictorial histories of Rhode Island labor, oral histories of Rhode Island working people with a whole lot of photos, and then finally in 1992, Vanishing Rhode Island, which was my photo book of places that no longer existed, of how the physical built environment but also the natural environment was disappearing under the breakdown of the factories and the disappearance of the countryside. So I guess I had never been very far from pictorial ideas, but they did vary greatly from cartoons to photos to other kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I was alive to the idea of finding some new means of expressing socially critical and radical ideas through images. We didn't touch back where we'd done earlier, I think in an earlier interview with the Radical America Comics in 1969. George, I was told, or he told me, that when an issue of Radical America arrived, he was a subscriber, and it was a comic book, he thought perhaps he'd been given the wrong magazine, that he'd been given a subscription to a comic magazine or a comic book series. But, you know, I've thought about that since, and I think he was so enthusiastic about expressing so critical, socially critical radical ideas in popular form mm-hmm. that he may very well have been tickled by it. Well, puzzled and tickled.
As you know, he was the
he kept it.
Historian of the origins of fascist culture
yes, right.
and popular culture.
Right.
And because his youth was so disrupted,
yeah.
he actually read all those
right.
things. He loved reading popular
right.
culture
right.
and comedy. He always
right.
was in,
right. Right.
He wasn't in the, like Marcuse,
yeah.
at the gymnasium. He
right.
was reading comic books.
That's right.
So
that's
he did.
Right.
He loved that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah,
sure
yeah.
I'm sure he saw the potential.
And I think he and others, as they flipped through the pages of Connections, really the first underground newspaper, were as taken by the layout as they were by the rhetoric.
Coming from a media family.
Yes.
Too.
He, that, of course, that's right. The media,
yes.
the newspaper media was reinvented in front of his eyes.
Right.
It didn't last, this yes. one didn't last forever, and it wasn't capital intensive or corporate whatsoever. But it was a newspaper idea, and they used to say about Madison up until 1980 that it was one of the most newspaper-rich cities in the United States, because there were a bunch of alternative newspapers that disappeared, and some of them were so left-wing they competed against other left-wing newspapers. There was Connections and Madison Kaleidoscope and Takeover and King Street Trolley, and then others that are not even in memory because they appeared and disappeared. But it was a newsprint was cheap. And Madison was a place where people could actually get interested in anything new and where there were plenty of handicraft and small companies that were happy enough to throw $50 down to have an ad in some little paper. And even now you see little ones, but they're almost all gone. But that would be the idea then.
Sure. And so you and Mary Jo left, but then you came back in the early 70s. You left in 71 and came back a couple years later?
Here's what happened. We when we were here, our favorite hangout, and for her, where she worked for 4 years, was the Historical Society. We loved it to pieces, and still do. And in order to complete our dissertations, and then for a little while longer to turn our dissertations into monographs, we found it best to return to Madison for as many weeks of the summer as we could rent somebody's house cheap. And that turned out to be maybe 6 to 8 weeks every summer between 1973 and 1982. I don't think there would have been a summer we would have missed during that time. And we couldn't really grasp what was going on in city politics, except as Dave Wagner would explain it to us. We observed the newspaper strike, of course, and other kinds of things, but we were just here for the summer doing our research and taking long bicycle rides. But in that way, we never really detached from Madison except for that next 20 years, in which I visited intermittently to give speeches or conferences, and Mary Jo almost never did, until we stumbled across Madison en route from Santa Cruz, California, to coming back to Providence in the summer of probably 05, and then realized that we needed to retire here and that our good friends would be here.
Was it that stark a realization that you were, in 2005, you stop here and say...
Pretty much. Our original idea had been to retire to Santa Cruz. Mary Jo was already having heart problems, and by 1995 I wanted to get her out of the academic East for at least a year in a quiet surrounding. But from the moment we got to Madison, to Santa Cruz, you would see some Madison bumper stickers, as you see some Santa Cruz bumper stickers in Madison. And some people would say, well, this is sort of like Madison, except it's in California. Except for the weather, which is entirely different. The city was run by a left-center coalition, pro-labor, which sought to limit sprawl and have good public transportation and other kinds of progressive policies. But there really was a sort of back and forth, as there would have been between Madison and Eugene, or Madison and Burlington, or half a dozen other cities that are of the same ilk. As it turned out, University of California at Santa Cruz was intellectually not a very lively place. Everybody's surfing. Why would they read books? And a lot of the faculty drive back to Berkeley every night. Why wouldn't you? Even over America's most dangerous highway, they have to get back to Berkeley. But also the medical facilities are very, very poor, so that sort of was impossible for Mary Jo. And then again, it's never been easy to make as many friends as you can easily make in Madison. And then again, Mary Jo grew up on Lake Michigan, maybe 15, 20 miles south of the Wisconsin line. And so I suppose we're indelible Midwesterners. And that is probably as important as anything else, but it took quite a while to realize that.
So we're over, we're roughly an hour now.
Uh-huh.
I at least want to get on the record. I want you to talk about history of the New Left.
Good.
Since it is, you know, imbued in
Indeed.
This town and this university.
Indeed.
So,
indeed. I guess I'd like to speak about history in the New Left and the biography of William Appleman Williams. Perhaps mentioning comics in Wisconsin, because it's not a distant subject.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, it started in Wisconsin, the documentation of the uprising of 2011, almost all in one breath, because these subjects don't seem very far apart to me at all. I wouldn't have thought so when History of the New Left appeared in 1990. It was part of my distant and receding past. But with these other books, it grew closer and closer to me, so that it looks as if it was almost a continuity, and as if in my mind I never left at all. So what would you like to ask about History of the New Left?
I think the question, and these actually I think are questions that John, through his
uh-huh.
pondering, so that the process primarily, so uh-huh. perhaps, you know, soliciting essays, was there politics?
Okay. This is a very interesting story and a very odd story. Somewhere in the later 1970s or early 1980s, Lee Baxendall got the idea of essays about Madison, mostly or largely about the later 1960s and the 1970s, perhaps inspired by the Soglin years, by the proliferation of cooperatives, by the struggle to make university radicalism, university-based radicalism, more relevant to the community, and a whole lot of other things. So Lee Baxendall started this project and even got an essay from Mossy. Dave Wagner told me that that essay was part of the package that was probably finished by the early 1980s. So Lee Baxendall could not complete this. Lee Baxendall had Parkinson's disease and was unable to go on with a number of other things in his life. And he turned the project over to Dave Wagner in hopes that Dave Wagner could complete it. But Dave Wagner, having suffered blacklisting for leading the newspaper strike, and then various other difficulties as he made a living as a newspaper man, handed it over to me somewhere around 1987. And I readily saw, trying to put this together as a book, that a whole lot was missing, and that it could be better reconstructed through taking the story back to roughly 1950 and following it through the lives of various intellectuals. Some of them actually got around to writing essays, but a striking number of them were asked by me to write essays and couldn't get it together. So this was the era in which I had founded the Oral History of the American Left, had a couple years of funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and was interviewing a whole lot of people, mostly over the age of 80. But I was traveling, and therefore, by the middle of 1980s, doing things like going to New York and going to Washington, D.C., and interviewing Saul Landau in his office at the Institute for Policy Studies, or going to New York and interviewing Herbert Gutman, going to, actually Herbert Gutman was visiting Providence when I interviewed him, going to New Jersey and interviewing Warren Sussman, and so forth and so forth. Half the people wrote, and the other half, or maybe a third, actually were interviewed by me, and then I sent them a rough transcript and we work from there to make those rough transcripts into respectable essays. And at the end of the process, I stuck in a couple of appendices that I had come across in archives or asked someone to send me when I heard that they existed. One was something that Warren Sussman had written about the Smoking Room School of History, that room in the Historical Society next to the door across from the Memorial Union, where everybody had met and talked seriously about history in 1951 and smoked cigarettes furiously, which was quite nice. And the second one was a document I must have gotten from Lee Baxendall, which was a bit of the play put on by the Anti-Military Ball of 1959, and written in part by Marshall Brickman, who of course worked on Annie Hall with Woody Allen. So those were delightful appendices. But much of the rest of it was a sort of push and pull operation, where I would find people who I urgently wanted to contribute. There was nothing by them. And I nagged them into writing something. And I'm very glad that I did, because it represents, you know, a little clip of memory. I don't know whether Paul Brynäs wrote The Mossy Milieu for me, or he wrote it earlier for Lee Baxendall, just as an example. But these stories and recollections, even some of them that were a little bit sour, were quite good in bringing back a story and sort of filling out what otherwise would be absolutely unknown, and which effectively, though I didn't know it then, launched me on the biography of Williams about 4 years later.
So did you ask Harvey to write anything?
I think he had died. As we were working on it, he had died.
Oh, okay.
So there was a piece by Ron...
McCrae.
Ron McCrae.
Right.
On him. That's right.
Yeah, 1990. Yeah, Harvey died in 87.
Yeah.
So what about... is Joan Scott in here?
She was, you know, so high up in the academic world that something like this didn't and wouldn't have interested her.
Well, it's an amazing group of people that you were able
it's
to...
It's eclectically, you know, a lot. Some of it is based on people I just happen to know personally. Mm-hmm. And one could say, why X and not Y? And I might not be able to answer that.
Mm-hmm.
Because after all, contributing this earned you nothing in the academic world, to say to speak of, nothing in a financial way. So it was almost like an old friends get together, and some of them, or at least one of them, Warren Sussman would never have permitted this interview to be published if he was still alive. Because this little cat, there's nothing negative in there, but a little bit too much insight into his personal life than he was familiar with, that he was comfortable with, being a very private person, or because he didn't accomplish the great things that he hoped he would accomplish. And even Herbert Gutman, they probably might have wanted to present themselves differently, but never gotten around doing it. That's a possibility. And so it's possible that in some of these cases of people who died recently, I sort of got their story more than they had ever gotten around to telling, or were likely to get around to telling if they lived another 10 years. Both of those guys died at age 58. So they died young, and their stories weren't told. Now, what I'd like to add is that as I began to work on the biography of Williams, who was dying just as I was beginning to write, I came to see Gerlerner to talk to her about Williams. She was his successor as president of the Organization of American Historians. And her memories weren't that great. She went to visit him. He was deeper in the throes of alcoholism than he'd been before. But he'd also tried to do these valuable things within the OAH, help to get young people to get jobs and bring more women to the fore and other kinds of benevolent things that he couldn't really carry through on, but Gerlerner did carry through on. And as I came to meet her, this would be in the early 1990s, she also pressed upon me my obligation as an oral historian to do some serious work with the Hollywood blacklistees, which her husband, her late husband, had been. Mm-hmm. And that probably was my launching point for another phase of the history I was never trained in Madison, because there wasn't a course in oral history. But somehow I think of it as in the milieu of Madison, historians and graduate students in history, what were you trying to do? You were trying to document everything. You were very serious about documenting everything. And you didn't believe in being stuck with one form of scholarship when there were a variety of forms of scholarship. And even if we didn't tap into the oral history projects, Civil Rights Oral History Project at the Historical Society, which is so incredibly important, it planted the seed of becoming an oral historian, mm-hmm. I'm quite sure. Well, where else would I have thought of founding the Oral History of the American Left in 1976, if I hadn't thought of it in Madison?
Well, you have in history someone like Heseltine, who always taught that course that engaged students in primary research, where it was basically based on biography, but also interviewing people. So there was that tradition.
Very much so. And Williams had his graduate students, including me. I wasn't his graduate student. I was a graduate student. His assignment to us, beyond the normal assignments to undergraduates, was to find documents and then write about the documents. And there was a graduate student named Steve Scheinberg, who was famous for taking undergraduates into the Historical Society archives and having them look at, you know, 1976 to 1986, this was nothing special. But in 1961, it was something very special, something that historians didn't do with students. So that's absolutely true, the sense that things could be documented, and they might be documented in ways that most historians, as we always like to say, those historians from the Northeast, the Schlesinger generation who hated the Beardian so much, would never disdain to do, because they were interested in the people in power. But we felt an obligation to do, and I have to add a footnote, and that is, after the generation of Heseltine and Merrill Jensen and Merle Curdy and several others I could name, the American historians, the U.S. historians, as we came in to teach, were a new generation who mostly wanted to get jobs at other universities and looked upon Madison as a way station, and hopefully they'd get to the Ivy League if they were really fortunate. They were not steeped in Wisconsin history as a rule. We didn't feel the kind of awe towards them that we felt toward Williams and memories of Heseltine and Merrill Jensen and Merle Curdy on the one hand, or Goldberg and Mossie on the other. There was a mutual non-admiration. They weren't so fond of us either. It may be that we U.S. historian graduate students, but all history graduate students, there were hundreds of us. We clung together. We had our own study classes. We had our own intellectual sessions. And so we did not need professors. And because our U.S. history professors, William O'Neill is a good example, since he was a perfectly affable fellow, and taught a course on radicalism with a huge enrollment that Mary Jo and I were teaching assistants for, did not awe us or impress us terribly. We were okay with them, and they were okay with us, but it was an uneasy relationship.
And they were doing, it was almost kind of a reversion to a very traditional history.
That's true. That's absolutely true. They were not in the Wisconsin school,
right.
Which is, in a way, the irony. The Wisconsin school had to leap over a generation to come back to something similar. Now, you could also say, and it would be very true, that the generation of studies in the left, most of them wanted to study the mechanisms of power. And unlike Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s group, they didn't admire the people in power. They quite disliked the people in power. But they thought of understanding history through the documents of the powerful, revealing the machinations of the powerful. Whereas, intuitively, instead of working it out intellectually, myself and my milieu wished to study not just the underclass, but all the things that hadn't been studied. After all, Mary Jo and two fellow graduate students went into the basement of the Historical Society, but also the basement of the Memorial Library and the Cutter Collection, and went through every book that had been written on the history of American women. There weren't that many of them, but they went through every single one of them and produced this article, which became a pamphlet for a women's history for several years, until a real women's history book appeared. So we weren't the only ones who were myself and my male friends weren't the only ones who were discovering. We were part of a generation that was urgent about discovering. What Jesse Lemish, a difficult person, called history from the bottom up. But there's there was a value to the phrase. And was inspired by E.P. Thompson in Britain, too.
But history of power relations.
But for the studies in the left, it would have seen power relations mm-hmm. from above.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, I wouldn't quite say power relations, because we were also inspired by Herbert Gutman, who was, like Thompson, trying to gauge the ordinary daily lives of working people in the past, or minorities in the past, who didn't have the power to challenge, didn't create a socialist revolution or even join socialist parties, but nevertheless had a life that was worth recording, and up to that time was very largely ignored.
John, do you have anything else you want? We're at about an hour and 50, well, hour and a half since we walked in here.
Uh-huh.
I want to make sure
you probably don't want to keep Paul much longer, but...
No, that's fine.
The only aspect, I don't know if you discussed the whole question of gender relations
and
the new left and this kind of romance.
Yeah,
you
that'd
be good.
Yeah, no, we didn't. So,
so that's very good to take up.
Yeah.
One of the striking things about that period, 1967 to 71, is that in 1967, you would have never seen on campus two males holding hands and looking romantically at each other, or two females. By the time we left campus, it wasn't an uncommon sight. That marks a very big change.
Well, you say it's still a bit uncommon.
It wasn't uncommon. It wasn't common.
Yes.
But you'd see it.
You would see it.
You would see it,
yeah,
and
right.
It wasn't
yes.
a cause for outrage and
right.
so forth. Now, I remember in 1970, at the time of the U.S. invasion of Cambodia and the huge uprising, seeing male and female couples, and part of the populace outside of Madison, or police presence, whatever, there would sometimes be jeers, but the jeers mostly didn't come from students. They may have come from engineering students, but even people who were surprised by it probably gave pause instead of shouted. Because it now was a sort of tolerated, if not approved, et cetera, et cetera.
But what about the relationship between men and women?
This is a deeper and more complex subject. I was reviewing a book of short stories by Marge Piercy, the famous poet, who'd been in Chicago before she moved to Boston and the Cape, and a well-known novelist. And in this collection of short stories, some of them from the 1960s, the most marked thing for me was the lack of sympathy that she had for women who were weak or male-centered, or especially who were just weak in character and didn't stand up to men. So that for graduate students, women were a minority, and it was very frequent for them to drop out of graduate school, because professors were not so friendly to them. Not bitterly hostile, but more likely to discourage than encourage. And when I received a teaching assistantship, and Mary Jo was eligible for a teaching assistantship, some professor, it might have been William O'Neill or it might have been someone else, said, well, only one to a family. And then he or someone else said, well, of course, Paul will be the one who gets the job. And I think the assumption then either was that the wife who was in graduate school would have children and not pursue a career, or perhaps she would teach at a junior college or something like, little did we know. And that was the accepted thing. And to a degree, it was also true in the anti-war movement that the minority of forceful speakers were women. And those forceful speakers tended to be women who were tough as nails, like Ann Gordon, who chain-smoked camels, you know, and took shit from no one. But it was hard for someone like Ann Gordon, a militant feminist, to be close to women who were much more passive or male-oriented or something like that.
And what about the way men treated women in the movement? Because there is always that kind of pull towards the romantic activist,
right.
Male, you know,
indeed.
Che Guevara.
Indeed, kind of indeed. In all of the social movements, that certainly was there. The men would be the speakers and traveling from town to town and girl to girl and so forth and so forth. I think on this campus, I saw this the SDS slogan, "Girls say yes to boys who say no," speaking of the war. And there has to be some truth in that truism, because the young men were in a very, very difficult situation, as the women weren't in that respect. But I think it would be true to say in Madison, and true from 1960 on, that that exceptional women were less exceptional here than in other major campuses. They had a hard time. They often had to be tough and not particularly kindly toward, didn't have to be, but they were often not particularly kindly disposed towards women who weren't tough. But Joan Scott would be in that generation of women who found some professor who would treat them in an egalitarian way. But even George, our dear friend, after some lecture, Liz Ewan recalls, he had graded a paper, and he said, "This is very good for a girl." And Liz Ewan said, "No, it's very good for any student." So so much was the practice of gender expectations for males different from gender expectations for females, from intellectual work in the classroom to future careers, that it was very hard even for sympathetic and gay professors to divest themselves from this kind of general attitude. And everybody sort of felt about Harvey Goldberg that he was very sweet in his male graduate students and undergraduate males because he was romantically inclined towards them. And I think that generalization wouldn't be entirely false.
All right.
Have we exhausted every possible subject?
We could go on, I'm sure, for quite some time, but I think at least for today we've exhausted every possible topic.
Maybe we'll come back to it again.
Who knows?
Yes, thank you very much for your time.
I'm happy to